I'm exhausted. It's time for Twit. We have an amazing show. Greg Farrow is back from the Packet Pushers Network. Our futurist Amy Webb from the Signals are talking. We are going to talk about everything from voting machine vulnerabilities to the real reason why Intel and the MacBook Pro are a match made in hell. At least it's as hot as hell. And China's secret plans. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 676, recorded Sunday, July 22nd, 2018, falling asleep as the robots wake up. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Quip, the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Visit getquip.com/twit to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Stamps.com. Buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. To get our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Twit. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens. And help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/twit and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we get together with some of the best, brightest, most fun people in technology and talk about the week's tech news. And we decided today, normally we have a four-person panel. We decided today we were going to do three because I have two of my favorite people and I want to give them equal time to talk, starting with Amy Webb, who I just adore. Amy, oh, you've redecorated.
Oh, I'm at home today.
Oh, so normally,
yeah, different normally stuff behind me.
We see her whiteboard predicting the future. She is a futurist, which is a very handy person to know. She is a founder of the Institute for the Future and the author of the fabulous Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. I'm happy to see a Washington Post bestseller, a winner of the 2017 Gold Axiom Award, Fast Company's Best Books of 2016, Amazon's Best Books of 2016. Congratulations. You did very well with this.
Thank
you. Nice job.
Thanks.
Nice job. Her Future Today Institute is at futuretodayinstitute.com. I got the name wrong. futuretodayinstitute.com. Thank you, Amy, for being here. We were talking before the show because Amy lived in Japan. How many years did you live in Japan?
I was in Japan for 6 and China for 1.
Wow. And actually, the beginning of the book, The Signals Are Talking, talks about how by living in Japan, you were able to get a sense of what the future was going to look like because it was already happening in Akihabara. And you told me not to go to Akihabara, and that was good advice. But I love Tokyo. I had a great time. Anyway, thank you for all the tips.
I'm happy you.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Also with us, another favorite of mine, and I love it when Greg Farrow is in studio.
It's good to be here.
From the Packet Pushers Network, yeah. Ethereal Mind.
I've been staying away from traveling, but if I'm here, I'm here. I'm coming.
I beg you, please, always make an effort to get here.
Sure.
And between these two, I mean, there's no reason to have another person because you guys know it all. And I just wanted to make sure that there was no question that, you know, if you had something to say, you would get to. I'm just going to shut up and let you let you talk. Two of my favorite people. So this is going to be
a lot of
fun.
High bar.
No, not for you, Greg. Truthfully, we don't really need Amy or me. Greg has his own podcast. Thank God. What brings you out here?
I was out for Network Field Day, which is an event where we do 7 vendors in 3 days, and we get briefings, and we jump in a limo and drive between all
of them.
Is
something you do for your company? Or?
It's a group. It's an influencer program.
Oh,
I work mostly in enterprise IT, so my podcast, the Packet Pushers podcast, is about enterprise IT, data networking, and enterprise IT technology.
Did you go see Cisco?
Yeah, not this time around. We saw
Did you ask them about their back doors?
I've been fairly critical about Cisco's back
doors. Holy cow. They just discovered it, what, a 6th back door?
Well, they do seem to have a systemic problem. They must have pretty bad development practices internally to sort of in that part of the company. Some parts are
fifth backdoor,
but a hard coded static backdoor.
And
in
we
a
actually
product it's one they always come in one particular family of product, and it sort of shows that that part of the company seems to have a fairly obsolete way of doing business.
It's the Cisco Policy Suite.
Yeah, it's part of the DNA Center. It's all based around Tomcat.
I think we use this here. Would it be something that you would use as a
No. No, it's very much an enterprise IT.
Well, we use Cisco filters. I mean, when I get blocked from my porn sites, it's always Cisco.
That'll be their security products.
Yeah, this Umbrella. It's called Umbrella.
Yeah, which is their online proxy service.
And damn you, Umbrella!
That's a company, and then Cisco's really an organization like lots of big companies, which has dozens of companies inside it, and some of them are good companies, and some of them are bad companies. This weakness has been the same business unit over and over, delivering pretty substandard.
Five backdoors in 5 months.
Yep. Which sort of says there's something wrong with that business unit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I always think it's interesting when a company discovers a backdoor.
Yeah. You put that in air quotes, didn't you?
Well, yeah, so it's my, you didn't hear it, but I mean, it seems odd to me that, you know, unless the organization is just completely misaligned and there's no communication, but it seems odd that a company would discover, you know, a backdoor five times.
It's like the, it's like how Symantec discovered. this is a current story, but it goes back in time. In 2006, there was a election machine company that was putting remote access, PC Anywhere, a Symantec product, on their voting machines. Now, these weren't the machines that voters used. These were the machines that counted the votes. Yep. So the fact that these machines were not only on the internet, but had remote access software running on them.
Yep. Now, this is really scary because PC Anywhere is about as secure as an open front door.
Well, that's what made me think of this because it turns out in that time frame of 2006, the PC Anywhere source code had been leaked out to hackers.
That's right.
But Symantec didn't tell anybody to 2012.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question, though. So, Emily, let me play devil's advocate. So I'm Symantec, I'm Cisco, whatever. What other way is there, once you discover a vulnerability, to get firmware to a consumer like my dad, right, who is just not super tech savvy? And, you know, many people don't find and install updates on a regular basis. So isn't there a reasonable case to keep creating those backdoors so that there's a way to ship the firmware updates?
Well, the challenge should be is that if you're going to make a product like that, PC Anywhere was a bodge to fix a bodge. So these these election machines were often made out of Windows 95 or, you know, Windows 2000.
Yeah, this was 2000 to 2006, so very and likely something like that.
There was no remote access tools in the operating system, and you had to apply something after the fact. My reading of the situation is that those voting machines aren't used very often, and it's not a high-value contract.
It was, at the time, the number one voting machine maker in the U.S.
Yeah, but they're not big business. Like, it's only like a tens of millions of dollars.
It's not. Yeah, you're right, because it's just the county seat that has it.
See, the problem that you have, the fundamental problem with IT security is that the IT security has to cost less than the thing you're protecting. But most IT security costs a whole lot of money. Like, security companies are charging so much cash for their products and expecting to make so much money, and that people just don't buy it and deploy it.
Can I just point out, if you were going to pick one system that you wanted to be secure and reliable, it would be the system that counts votes.
Yeah, but that's not got a dollar value in it.
No, but right? it's got a value.
Here's a $50 million.
It also highlights the fact that all technology in the United States serves two masters, right? So it serves DC and it serves Wall Street. And the problem is that most often the avenue upon which technology proceeds as it's getting better and better runs counter to the best long-term interests of...
Uh-oh, they're listening.
Sorry, they're listening. That was Russia. Russia's calling to tell me to shut up. I'm letting their secrets...
You raise an interesting point because Friday I had an interview with Adam Fisher, who's got a new book called A Valley of Genius. It's interviews with 200 of the really interesting people who created Silicon Valley over the last 20 years. I mean, all the names, and it covers everything from Atari to Twitter and everything in between. I mean, it's a really wonderful book. He made an interesting observation, and maybe you can, what you just said, it follows on what you just said, Amy, which is that until recently it was, you nailed it, it was the finance and government. It was Wall Street and Washington. because we were talking about why New York City hates Silicon Valley, why the New York Times hates Silicon Valley. He says it's becoming Silicon Valley that drives the agenda these days. And it's one of the reasons you see such antipathy from, especially from East Coast media to, like the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, towards Silicon Valley, and why you see so many stories about programmers and, oh, these morons. You know, I remember a story the New York Times did about the blockchain houses where these silly people have Bitcoin Avenue.
But, I mean, all of these people are that.
They are that. They're certainly stupid. Vulnerable. Yeah. However.
But they're also stupid and childish and immature. They have very little grounding in philosophy.
You might have read the excerpt from Adam's book in, I think it was in Vanity Fair. No, or it was New York Magazine. Anyway, about the programmer culture that started Facebook and how they just were, it was one massive kegger, basically, for the first 5 years of Facebook.
You could argue it still is today.
It may still be.
I mean, the point is that a lot of these organizations are run in this moral isolation. And there's not even any acknowledgement that humanity is actually a thing. And they're in there doing their thing and saying the technology will change the world and we believe that any technology we give you will make your life so much vastly better, while conveniently forgetting that most people don't want it, don't need it, didn't ask for it, don't, you know.
That was I'll add one on to that.
Yep.
So there's more isolation than just a bunch of people who think that they can change the world. It's a homogenous group of people. So it's a homogenous group of people trying to make the world better in their image, which never aligns with everybody else's idea of what a great world is, right?
He used as an example, he said, Adam Fisher said, look at 3D printers. Silicon Valley decided, oh, this is the next big thing. Probably because they read a lot of science fiction that involved printing your next car, or maybe they watched The Replicator in Star Trek and said, oh, I want that. So they decide it's the next big thing. It becomes a big, you know, product category. Every, you know, middle America goes out and buys it, uses it for 1 week, says, this is crappy, puts it in the closet. It's dead by now, right? It's a dead category by now. It'll still be used by industry.
Well,
I mean, it
is
important.
I think part of that is whenever Silicon Valley decides, or that group of people, and as
But this
Amy
is his
said,
point, is that they decide what we are going to get the next
But they're
day.
Also very good at feeding a hype machine
creating
hype, right? And unlike companies of old who would go out and do ad campaigns on television, and it would be this slow build as the marketing campaigns rolled out, Silicon Valley's, you know, technology people, not just Silicon Valley, it's a global thing right now. I like to think of Silicon Valley as just one of many places where innovation is happening. I don't see Silicon Valley as being the only place where it happens.
Right.
They're very good at hacking the marketing to get the thing happening very, very quickly. So the 3D printing thing, yes, it did capture a zeitgeist or a piece of the imagination, but they're also very good at getting a grassroots movement behind it.
Right.
So they're able to reach out and get the – and that feeds its own feedback loop. Right. So I don't know – that they're also self-believing, but they're also able to tap into grassroots. Where before New York Times was the tastemaker, they would go out and say, this looks really cool. And there'd be one or two journalists who'd publish an article, and because they're standing on a platform with the loudest mega, you know, loud hailer, they get to make the taste. And those people are peeved because they're no longer doing that.
That's right.
Right? So a lot of those...
Hollywood too, right?
I don't know if I agree with with that assessment entirely. I don't think that the New York Times is ticked off that they are no longer the ones sort of anointing what is a trend or what the cool things are, and therefore they've gone after the Valley. I think that the Valley has had a pass for a very, very long time. And a lot of the technology as it's been developed has sort of gone unchecked, and we are in the midst of a reckoning. So that's why we wind up with, you know, Facebook problems and
it's
Twitter problems.
It's never one thing. I think it's, you know, a bit of a loss of control and loss.
There is, though, right now, would you agree, a tension between the media elite in the Northeast, Washington, D.C., and the technologists, whether they're in Silicon Valley or Seattle. Washington.
I would take that a step further. I would also point out that old capital is also competing in the temperature.
That
right?
might even be a better way to characterize it. Old capital and old power.
That's right. Old capital and old power. So you're looking at an alignment of media, industrialists, the government, which is all old
power. And you know what really pisses them off? that Donald Trump was able to use social media, and particularly in Facebook, to galvanize a group of voters that never voted before and win the presidential election. That just cheeses everybody off, except Silicon Valley.
There was an article this week saying he is the largest political advertiser on Facebook today.
To this day.
Yeah. Right now, even. So.
To this day.
Yeah.
So I suspect
it furthers a point. I mean, Stanford did a study recently. They interviewed, I think, 600 different developers on their political views and religious views and everything else. You know, and obviously 600 is not statistically relevant given how many people work in Silicon Valley, but it was a pretty good cross section. And all of those viewpoints were homogenous. I'm not saying I'm excited that Donald Trump is the number one political spender on Facebook, and I'm not super elated with how the world has turned out at this particular moment in time. But, you know, it just sort of goes to show that we talk about media elites all the time. We don't often talk about tech elites. And there is very much an elite ideology and culture and set of ideas that are alive and well.
I think that's true. It's fairly homogeneous. I mean, I think that's accurate.
Yeah.
There are the Peter Thiels of the world who are completely run counter to that.
But it's the same with industrialists or old media. They're all homogenous too. They're not embracing of new groups or new things.
Right.
You know, the ability of the old organizations to be non-homogeneous was limited.
I do wonder, and actually, Amy, you probably have some data on this because this is right up your alley, but I do wonder if the power of social media these days, particularly Twitter and Facebook, was not fully understood and embraced. And because it allowed an outsider to march right into Washington, D.C., that is a huge shift that was not foreseen or understood by anybody.
I think the number of people working
again,
out.
Go ahead, let Amy and then.
So Ev Williams and I, a year and a half ago, were both at a meeting. Somebody asked him whether or not, as they were developing Twitter, they ever saw sort of the way that Twitter unfolded as a remote possibility. And the answer was, and to be fair, he's responsible to shareholders. But the answer was, you know, we've always just been working on the product. And from my vantage point, that answer was either willfully, you know, he was either lying he literally and the team literally never thought about the future, which to me seems unlikely given what they had done previously, or they didn't care.
I have a fourth point of view.
Okay.
And I really believe this is true. I think Ev, who founded Twitter, I think Zuck, who founded Facebook, and all of the engineers who work are doing what engineers do without a point of view. They're optimizing the software. They're optimizing for the priority for both Twitter and Facebook, which is engagement and attention because they sell advertising against it. Actually, I don't know what Twitter does against it, but that's what they want. And this is how engineers are. They're not really thinking about who benefits or anything. In fact, if anything, Facebook says it's good because everybody connects. That's good. Okay, stipulated. How do we maximize for attention?
Incredibly naive.
That's a really important insight.
Yeah,
that's an incredibly important insight because there is a push-pull tension between what is exacting and what is optimizing, and that is the push-pull that you see between traditional media and new media.
You better explain
or media
that.
And the valley.
What's exacting?
So all of technology now is about optimization. So within the realm of AI, there is no singular no systems are being designed to produce exact answers. They are in solutions. They are being designed to optimize. So and there are many, many reasons for that.
So,
but I think that
something like Google Homes, because when you ask Google Home for a factual, it has to give you the answer.
Mm. Yeah,
that's exacting.
Well, no, it has to give you a answer.
It has to that's right.
It doesn't have to give you the answer, and the answer doesn't have to be correct. It just has to give you a answer to be successful.
Because the engineers optimize for speed of responsiveness. Yeah. They optimize.
Right, but that's the question, though. That was the insight. Who are they optimizing for?
Yep.
What are they optimizing for? And the challenge is that typically what's being optimized for is whatever gets to market fast, like whatever that KPI
or the business priority of the company. And if it's Facebook's case, Facebook's entire priority is increasing the amount of time you spend on Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. That's like number one, job one. So when they created the news feed, and ever since, they've been optimizing for engagement, for attention. And I don't think they're evil. In fact, I think they're good engineers. They've done a damn fine job. But somebody, nobody, Zuck on down, has thought about, well, what do you get when you do that?
The implications.
The implications.
Yeah, they've never, I think, remember when Twitter first
engineers
started?
Engineers are not into implications. They're into solutions. They're problem solvers.
They're focused on the goals.
They're problem solvers.
Right? And the problem is that when we first started out with Twitter, remember how it used to crash all the time and we couldn't do anything?
Yeah.
So the engineers were actually spent most of their time trying to keep the site up.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden when the system was able to scale, they redeveloped all the software and got it all working and then added some features. Engagement grew, so they cycled on engagement. Yeah. Now we're working our way through what engagement is, and suddenly we're saying, oh, you've got to start thinking morally. Well, I'll bet there's a whole bunch of engineers inside of these companies thinking about what is morally acceptable.
Are they?
The challenge is moral acceptability is not easy to determine.
Nor is it optimized for profit.
So what happens?
It might optimize to avoid going to jail or getting called into Congress. But if you think about your smartphone, if you think about every single video game, every product of Silicon Valley is a product of engineering minds attempting to solve a problem and optimize.
Let's keep a sense of balance here, right? Remember that cars were invented roughly in the 1920s, and they used to kill people at a phenomenal rate for a long period of time.
They still are, by the way, 1 million people a year in the worldwide.
Exactly. And then there's a lot of people, it took like a couple of decades before the law came around and started saying you have to consider the moral impact of these vehicles. And, you know, they forced drivers to walk around with a person waving a flag in front so the horses wouldn't.
A lot of good that did.
Right. But, I mean, these things take time.
But this also...
And it's also iterative. Points, you move through
a 100 years ago that we had the flagman.
It's a process of awakening.
Take time. It's a century.
Yeah. I do wish our engineers were...
That's another interesting insight. And, and again, it goes to what and who are we optimizing for. So the year 1917 is the year that the very first flying car patent got filed. so this is relevant because Google's, you know, big secret flying car project finally went public like 2-3 weeks ago. And it's an example of innovation imitation, right? So we keep coming up with what we feel and think are novel solutions, big ideas. We're optimizing for what people need right now. And somehow we forget that we're just inventing the same, you know, we're constantly reinventing the same solutions to the sort of same problems. And every year since 1917, somebody has invented and flown a flying car.
But this time it's going to work.
Yeah.
But this time it's going to work. But I mean, this is sort of the, I think this is sort of what happens when we're optimizing all the time.
This is Larry Page's flying car.
Yeah, well, but I mean, we keep coming back to it over and over
again. Adam and I talked about this also, Adam Fisher, author of Valley of Gods, because there's a guy that's very little known in Silicon Valley. In fact, I'm going to test you guys. You ever hear of Scott Hassan? He's the third founder of Google. When Larry Page and Sergey Brin were graduate students, right? They were going for their PhDs. They came up with this as research for a PhD. That was their goal. They weren't trying to build a business. Scott Hassan was the guy assigned to the computer lab so that the PhD students could have some code written.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to Scott and say, can you write this search thing? And it was Scott who basically wrote the original Google algorithms and, in fact, said, you know, this could be a business. Larry and Sergey said, who wants to do a business? There's Excite. There's Alta Vista. There's no need.
Today, Android as we know it sits at the...
Sorry, little side talk there from the... Thank you, Internet. So anyway, Scott Hassan has an interesting theory. He's still around, very smart guy. He says, we're not doing self-driving cars. He said, we're going to skip that. It's a regulatory nightmare because every single locality has to approve it. Insurers have to go for it. And users have to be willing to get in a car with no steering wheel. That's going to be a problem. You know what's cool? Flying cars.
Yep.
He said, now that we have autonomy, batteries are getting good enough so that the efficiency of a flying car is the same as a car on the ground. And autonomy solves the problem of flying cars because you don't want humans flying around in these flying cars because... If you think a wreck on the freeway is bad, what about a wreck 100 feet over your head? But once we have safe, autonomous flying vehicles, it's one regulatory agency, one, the FAA. That's it. He's of the opinion that in the next 20 years, you're going to completely skip autonomous vehicles and go to flying cars. You're the futurist. You say, no way, Amy Webb.
Yeah. So for many of the same reasons, none of the regulatory infrastructure is in place. We would have to effectively create invisible highways in the sky. The sense of an avoid technology that would be required for any of for a flying car to work in a city with buildings.
A lot cheaper to build an invisible highway in the sky than a single freeway on the ground.
Sure.
A lot cheaper.
But, imagine
no cars on the freeway. It would be a bicycle and pedestrian paradise.
You're in California. I'm on the East Coast where we are surrounded by enormously tall buildings.
Well, you fly higher.
You can't because then the risk.
Then you're up in the airspace of actual, you know.
So the challenge here is you have to create high. I thought a little bit about this. When you follow the planes, if you create highways, you have to have clear space underneath because when they crash, you can't crash into buildings.
Right.
So what are you going to do? Run them over the top of existing highways, or are you going to run them over clear ground? So that means you would actually have to go and clear in a city. You would have to clear flying lanes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or you go underground.
Oh,
so this is
boring.
This is where
that's so
boring. I know everybody loves everybody. Yes, it's so boring, and I know everybody loves to make fun of Elon Musk.
The boring company.
Yep.
But to me, this is like such a great conversation to tee off any other conversation we have tonight, because it's a good reminder that a lot of the technology that feels new and fresh or the tech related problems that we have are cyclical, and somebody's already done a flavor of it. And it just feels novel and new.
Look at the London Underground. It was built in the 1820s, and they used to have horses dragging the carts along the tunnels. And then later they had coal powered trains. Can you imagine being in an underground tunnel
smoky,
with coal-fired steam trains dragging the trains along? That would have been.
My favorite, this isn't it. There's pictures of the London Underground. They were like little living rooms.
Yes.
And of people going on the London.
Yeah.
How about this? The tube.
Yeah.
Going in, this is basically a mining cart.
Yes,
that still exists in Washington, D.C.
What?
So,
that's in Congress, right?
That's right. So you can take, not a tourist. You have to like be there for a reason. But there is a little tiny train that looks just like that.
I've ridden it. It's really cool. It gets members of Congress from the Capitol building to their offices and back.
So, I take your point, Amy, that the idea of a tunnel is a 250-year-old idea coming back to life.
But
Flying cars are deeply impractical because, yes, there's only one regulation body, and quite often these...
a regulation body that loves flying. Look how they've treated drones. They love this stuff. They want you to fly their car.
The challenge here is that these people have these really rose-colored glasses. They want to believe that these things that they come up with, these ideas, are actually going to work, and yet they very rarely do.
Here's Paddington Station
Look at self-driving cars. Was it like 5 years ago when the first self-driving cars came out, and we were all supposed to be in self-driving cars?
No. The very first self-driving car was launched by a GE and RCA project in the 1950s, and it was an electric car that drove around a self-contained track. So again, like, we feel like it's our generation that invented the self-driving car, and we're not. That's a technology that's 70 years old.
But we are now, for the first time, in a position where it could actually work because of autonomy, because of batteries, because of new efficiencies in manufacture.
It's still going to take decades.
I think a lot of this has to do with the way that we tell stories. And the stories that we tell about transportation are visceral because we have seen flying cars in movies, and we have seen, you know, cool people movers. What we have never seen are super lightning fast, super far underground systems that get us around. And so we don't have a story. We don't have a framework. And so it's hard for us to
push. I think there are challenges, and there is also great expense to digging holes.
Sure.
Not so much.
Well, actually, compared to
Boston and the Big Dig.
What a nightmare. Yeah.
I mean, but there's also political issues.
Yeah.
So you've got your airspace overhead, which seems like it's politically more tenable. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Compared to the nightmare on the ground, the ground, I don't know, because I don't think what would be the use cases besides wells and oil?
And I invite you both, TWIT 1000. You can come in your Uber flying car.
Yeah.
You'll be up here in half an hour. Amy, you'll be here in a few hours because you're all the way from the East Coast. You can take your tunnel if you want. Actually, aren't we supposed to be building a tunnel to L.A. from San Francisco? I thought that was that.
Elon Musk's boring company is doing pilot projects.
No, but I thought that there was like already, maybe not. Like
a high-speed tunnel.
Yeah. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen in Japan.
And Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They invented the bullet train in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of other investors moving into the market as well, now that he's sort of proven out the concept, early movers in
that
market.
I still think there's so many problems with boring holes in the ground.
There's so many more problems with flying cars.
No, it's the future.
I saw it on the Jetsons.
We've seen a couple of self-driving cars have accidents, and we've seen the world have apoplectic fits over that. Imagine what happens when a half a dozen flying cars fall out.
Because autonomy is going to solve that. Go ahead, Amy.
I want to play a quick game of Would You Rather.
Oh, yeah.
Would you rather have your only mode of transportation be flying car, autonomous car, or car that is part of an underground system?
Flying car, like in a heartbeat. Imagine I pull out my, by the way, this is why Uber's valued at billions of dollars. I pull out my phone. I hit the Uber app. I said, I need to get to the city. It lands right here. I get in. There's no driver. It's just a pod, a drone pod. And I go and then I get out and it goes away. There's no parking. There's no traffic.
That's assuming there's a landing space.
And what if
there's no other traffic around it for 100 meters in any direction?
We already got helipads and all
the
high-rises.
There's no hurricanes and no wind.
Okay, what if
there's no updrafts or downdrafts?
Have you ever been in a... You can't come here in a hurricane.
Have you ever...
Sorry.
Have you ever been in a light aircraft flying in thermals over the desert?
It's not fun.
When it goes into a 500-foot downdraft and you literally just drive...
I was in a glider.
Yep.
It was the last flight of the day because they said it's getting too windy. We can't fly anymore. But you come on up.
Yeah.
that was a nightmare.
You only fly in that once, right? Mm-hmm. I was flying in a little tiny F-28 over the Australian desert.
Imagine no engine and you're in a glider and it's doing that.
Yeah, I know. So I think flying cars are complete rubbish.
Because I want a flying car. Okay, would you rather?
So Leo's flying car. Greg, what are you?
Autonomous car on the ground. The reason is that underground will have limited stops and destinations, so it won't be where I am. So if you're saying that I want a flying vehicle for suburban work, well, then you have to assume that you have enough space to fly down and for it to park, and you have to have safety zones around it. That means no trees.
It's the size of a flying car parking space. You could land anywhere.
But if you've got a nice breeze, it'll blow you into a tree, and then you're dead.
No. Drones can handle hurricanes. You've seen drones handle
all sorts
of wind.
But only if they go like this, and you're willing to let them fall out of the sky.
You'll get used to that. They're not going
to run out of the sky. You have to shift your balance around inside the vehicle.
All right, let's try it with a studio audience. Would you rather, let me see, those of you who would rather have a flying car, 2, 3. Those of you who would rather go in a hole in the ground, none.
Hole.
0. Ah. Those of you who would like an autonomous vehicle, that's the most. That's 4. You win.
It's a lack of foresight.
I would definitely go in a hole in the ground for long haul. Instead of getting in a plane, I will go in a hole in the ground.
I mean, when I'm in New York, I take the subway. I love the subway.
That's right. And that if you said to me there's a way to get from San Francisco to Portland or whatever in a hole in the ground, then I'm all up for that. But getting in the challenges around flying cars are just impractical. You're literally going to have a problem in the States by saying I have to build a landing spot in everybody's back garden. And most people don't have back gardens.
One of the models that I've been building is around the next economic centers. And given what we know to be true about microclimates and extreme weather changes and everything else, it's highly likely that sometime within the next 50 years, our new economic centers in the U.S. would be places more like Denver.
Yeah.
And
lots
Wichita.
Of room for flying cars to land in Denver.
And then who's going to complain about the noise? You know how loud those things are?
Yeah, the noise is an issue.
Yeah. Noise, trees, parking spots. And then if the weather's bad, you can't fly in a car.
Don't you wish that we could just jump ahead 20 years and see?
But other than those small little things, you can imagine those flying cars.
My answer is no.
What? I don't. You're a futurist. Your whole career is based on that.
Because I am so concerned about the decisions that are being made today. I don't want to go 20 years into the future because I don't want to live in that place. So my hope is that we make better decisions.
You see where we're headed.
Yeah. I do not want to go to there.
I'm not talking about scooters, by the way, because, gosh, those things are like rubbish.
Oh, you're going to see scooters for
e-scooters.
In the interim, you're going to see e-scooters everywhere.
I've just been in San Jose.
They're everywhere.
And they're just all over the place. It's like litter.
Totally.
Just, I can't imagine.
I saw that first in Santa Monica, where this all began with Bird.
Seemed like a good idea, but I think in practice, it's just like.
Yeah, because they just leave them. The idea
But people leave them in the middle of the footpath, not just at the edge or near the building. They leave them right
there. They leave them in the middle. They just like hop off.
Hop off, let it fall over. It's just lying there.
I watched somebody leave one right in the middle of the door to Chipotle the other day. I'm just sitting there.
Are these like city bike scooters? I haven't seen these out in New York yet.
Yeah, you will.
Great. Wonderful. It's another thing for us to complain about.
It's the next big thing.
Yeah.
I'll show you. Let's see. And then we're going to take a break. I wish I had made more hours for this show because you guys are so much fun. So, Amy, what if you could just visit the future for an hour and then come back? I don't mean you have to live there.
Yeah, no, I think about it all the time.
No?
I don't.
You really think it's going to be that bad?
No, I worry about my own. So the answer is if I suffered no psychological damage, if I didn't go through the shock, right?
And if the pollution doesn't kill me.
Right. If, and I would want, the only way I would do it is if I went so far into the future that none of my current family members would be alive because it would be impractical. So I don't want to jump ahead 20 years and like,
and then you'd also
or maybe I could go to the future and not encounter anybody that I know and just like look at tech.
But it'd be no point in going forward to the future in New York without seeing what's happening in London and then somewhere rural and then in Bangladesh and the Philippines, because the future's never evenly distributed.
Well, of course.
Right? So
But then, like, who's got that kind of time?
No, I don't.
Especially without our underground tunnels.
Yeah, that's right.
If I could get to it, I'm going to find it somewhere. There's a picture of me and one of those Bird scooters in San Francisco, and it's exactly as you say. They are literally litter. I have to go back in time. It's easy to go back in time, by the way. It's very hard to go forward in time these days.
Are the scooters hard to ride?
The Lime scooters are lime green, and they have an interesting feature which they had to disable, that if somebody touches them without actually booking the scooter, they go, "Stand back, stand back. Police are being called now. Stand back, stand back." Which is extremely, if you think car alarms are bad, extremely annoying.
Especially when they're in the middle of the footpath and you stand on them to walk past.
Yeah, they had to disable that feature. That is turned out to be a bad idea, especially since
on the flip side,
the scooters had no way to call the police. Yeah, so
the scooters are a good idea in the sense that something like 60% of all journeys in the city are actually less than 2 kilometers.
Well, that's the thing. It makes perfect sense.
It does make sense.
Well, how about like walk?
No.
It was on my mind, but that's hardly exactly. Silicon Valley like, can't take a profit, can't like take a margin on walking.
There's no margin on walking.
There's no margin in walking.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to market walking.
Actually,
nobody's going to come up with a.
You know what's making me walk a lot these days? Pokemon Go. There is a margin in walking. I've got kilometers under my belt trying to catch these silly things. All right, let's talk about something that's good for you, brushing your teeth. You know you have to brush your teeth. Everybody has to brush their teeth, right? You're doing it wrong, by the way, in many cases. I got a Quip, and I learned Quip is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. You're not brushing long enough. You forget to change your brush head. Maybe you're buying those Bluetooth toothbrushes that play music in your mouth. This Quip is great. It's an electric toothbrush. It's a fraction of the cost of those fancy brushes. It's $25. They have different models, but it starts at $25 is what I use. It's fantastic. There's no charger. It uses a AAA battery, which is fantastic. It lasts for months. It's a perfect travel brush. It also has a great case with a little sticky pad on it you can just put right up on the mirror so you don't forget to brush like that. And you'll automatically get, by subscription, new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months, and that's just $5 for the new heads, including free shipping worldwide. Quip is awesome, and it's so affordable, we actually got an extra Quip for the sleepovers, because kids, for some reason, never bring toothbrushes. So we just got some heads, put their names on it, and then when they come, they get their Quip. Everybody loves a Quip. Oprah put it on her O-list. Time magazine said it was one of the best inventions of the year. And, of course, the ADA approval doesn't hurt. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. I love our Quip. Go to getquip.com/twit, GETQUIP.com/twit. It starts at $25. You get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. So you'll have nice, fresh brush heads. Getquip.com/twit. This is a good idea. Thank you, Quip, for supporting Twit. And thank you, Twits, for supporting Quip. What goes around comes around. So I see you using a MacBook.
Yep.
From 2015 at the latest.
2012. Yep.
You like it?
Yeah, it's still working, although I'm starting to do a little bit of video lately. I've been doing some YouTubes.
Oh, yeah, slow for that.
Mostly for images of me drinking beer, which is a common habit of mine.
So I know you're going to mock me. But Apple's new MacBook Pro came out with the i9 processor, the first MacBook to support as much as 32 gigabytes of DDR4 RAM, not your slowpoke LPDDR3. No, DDR4 RAM.
Yes.
And its own dedicated graphics card, a Radeon 560. And for a mere $800 additional, you can get this. A thermally controlled tower that has a additional graphics processing unit, an eGPU that connects via Thunderbolt 3 to give it even more.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
That's the new garbage can?
It's the new garbage can, but guess what? It's not even a computer.
It's just a GPU.
It's just the graphics processor.
Wow.
There's been a lot of talk about it being an overheating monster. Dave Lee, who's a YouTuber, was the first to report this. He said he compiled or rendered a Premiere Pro video file. It took about half an hour to render, and he noticed that as it got hot, as the i9 6-core processor. And by the way, iFixit says that the new MacBook Pros have a completely unchanged thermal cooling system from previous Mac Pros, so no attempt was made to accommodate a chip that is 50% hotter and uses much more power. He noticed that as 5 minutes in, the GPU suddenly going boom down way down below spec. It's a 2.9 gigahertz i9 processor that peaks out at 4.8 gigahertz. It was operating at 1 gigahertz, 2 gigahertz, and it did that for the next half hour. It flapped.
Yeah.
It was slow. He said, "Oh man." Then he did something I would not recommend. He put it in the freezer. And it was like 25% faster.
The thing that strikes me about all of this is people seem to forget that they're running a laptop. Do you remember the days of the luggable?
Yeah.
And how many sacrifices
you
we
could
made
have a desktop replacement laptop that
That's
would
right.
be 12 pounds and have a jet engine in the back blowing the hot air.
Yeah. I mean, when last time I was here, you and I talked, I was here in January, I said Intel doesn't have any CPUs.
Right.
There probably won't be another release of MacBooks in 2018. So I got that wrong.
You were wrong.
I was wrong. But I still think I'm right because this is showing you that this chip is not fit for laptops.
Well.
Right? So my point is that this
I want to report my own experience because I foolishly spent more than $4,000 on an i9.
Excellent. Let's see how that works
I got the Intel. They have a little widget that shows clock speed, but I also have iStat menus, which shows clock speed. A couple of things I want to report. First of all, there's a number of different things you can do. One of the reasons I wanted to be faster was for Lightroom, because I use Lightroom. I'm an avid amateur photographer, and I use Adobe's Lightroom, which is the worst piece of software ever, because it's so slow. It's mostly Lua scripts, so it's not the most performant thing ever. And what was really getting me is that you'd import a bunch of raw photos, 42 megabyte files, and you'd want to go pretty quickly saying, yeah, that one's good. No, no, no. Yeah, that one's good. And it would take 3 or 4 seconds to go to each image. So this thing is great.
Yep.
And in fact, with Lightroom running in the background, rendering, pre-rendering images and stuff, the CPU goes up to about 4 gigahertz and kind of stays there.
Yeah.
Nice. Now, admittedly, when you're doing that, the battery life goes down to about an hour.
Yeah.
And the keyboard, which is the hottest part, we got one of those instant read thermometers. The keyboard goes up to 108 degrees, which is a little toasty for typing.
Yeah.
So admittedly, that's a problem.
Yeah.
If you do, and we tried it, we ran Handbrake, for instance, which is smart enough to use all six CPUs, peg them out, doesn't use the GPU, but use all six CPUs to render video. And yeah, you bet. Boom, boom, it goes up and then boom, goes down because it's too hot.
Too hot.
And in fact, if you look at the temperature, it goes up to 100 Celsius and stops. And as soon as it gets to 100 Celsius, everything slows down because it doesn't want to go over 100.
So it should have been. So what we should have seen was the Core i9 was meant to be a 10 nanometer Skylake processor.
A smaller, right? More efficient,
smaller,
cooler.
Smaller, narrower, cooler. And what's happened here is that, in my opinion, is Apple has sort of caved to the public opinion and said, we need to bring a new MacBook Pro to market. And all the work they've done with Intel's processors, which have been delayed, isn't able to be brought forward. So
you can almost blame Intel for this, frankly. Although Apple should have said, no, we're not going to do it. I have to say, though, as certain kinds of users, this is a great thing. I'm very happy with the Lightroom performance. When I'm just doing normal things, browsing, email, nothing heavy duty, the clock speed does go down about 2 gigahertz or 1.5 gigahertz, and I get 8 hours of battery life, just as I would want. Yep. So it is a great laptop, and when I'm compiling software, which is very bursty, very fast, runs programs very fast. It's only when you're doing stuff that...
Apps open fast?
Everything opens fast. Everything feels snappy. I love this machine. They kind of fixed the keyboard. It's not perfect, but I'm very happy. Now, probably shouldn't have spent $700 on the GPU.
I didn't realize that.
What
quite
is that intended
so
to be used for? Is
well,
that
you plug it in, and then it offloads the internal GPU. Right. And this thing is like a chimney. You feel the heat coming rising off of this. Mm. And in theory, I guess this was Apple probably knowing that the i9 was going to have thermal throttling, saying, well, if you really, I mean, you probably, look it. Yeah. You're using a laptop that's this thin to try to render 4K video. I wouldn't recommend it. No. Maybe you get the eGPU, maybe okay, it's okay. Really, you should be using a desktop PC or a desktop replacement from another company. Yeah. But you want to use
Final. I think the problem is there's just the average person.
They should not get this.
Expensive.
Yeah,
no, the good news is they're not going to because it's $4,000.
Right.
Actually, you can get up to $7,000 if you really try.
I think the thing is here, what we're seeing is we're reaching the limits of our current engineering. Intel has been unable to make the transition from 14 to 10. Haven't been able to bring out a GPU that Apple can get into the thermal envelope of the chassis. Now, I think it's possible that Apple had a new chassis design with a new thermal capability.
Yeah, this is a four-year-old chassis.
This is a four-year-old unibody Mac. It's not new. So it just sort of feels like they said this is the only decision we can make and put the i9 inside of the existing box.
And for some people like me, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Because for the kind of work I do, it's fine.
It is.
If you're a video editor or you're going to do long renders or you're going to do I tried my Fusion Pro Studio software rendering a 360. Don't, because it'll actually be slower than slower machine.
I think the thing to think about here is it's not so much the CPU performance that's going to take us forward. The i9 does have better memory performance because it's using the faster memory. It's got a new memory bus.
I wish it were Optane. Why is it not Optane?
Oh, now there's a big long story. I should send you a link about that. Basically, Intel hasn't been able to make Optane work.
This is the cross-point technology.
Why not?
Cross-point. The jury's kind of out, and I wouldn't like to get too much into the weeds about it because partly it's not loaded into the front of my head, but also because it's incredibly involved. But it looks like Intel just hasn't been able to get the technology to run it, to produce enough of it, and to bring the price down, and also because they made a decision to bring it out as a sort of an SSD replacement, like faster than SSD. And when they brought it out, they tried to make it run as a SATA controller instead of moving to NVMe. And so
the bottleneck is the I/O.
Yeah, which meant that
you can't keep up.
And the commitment, when we talked in the middle of last year and I came on the show and told you all about it and said how excited I was and it was going to be great, and they were talking like 1,000 times increase in performance and 100 times – you know, all these fantastic numbers. And they came out with a 10 times faster than SSD at 100 times, was it 100 times faster but 10 times the price of an SSD? Well, that's not what we were promised. And
I have a theory.
Yeah, and so they just weren't able to execute on the product. And there was a partnership between Intel and Micron to manufacture this, a cross-licensing agreement. And Micron is now – that partnership has now been dissolved, and Micron has completely stopped making the technology completely.
Wow.
So it's only Intel. And Intel's fab that makes those Optane chips is now shut down.
Oh, no.
So they've stopped making them completely.
So does this comport with your theory, Amy Webb?
So it does. So this sounds a, so here's my thinking. So if it's true that Apple's working on its own chips, right? And if it's true that Apple is, with the 2020 product suite release, intending to forego Intel and instead have its own.
Oh, I don't know if it's going to be by 2020. You think it'll be that soon, next year or 2 years?
That's what everybody's, I mean, it's like a year and a half, right? So if we assume that sometime between now and the next 24 months, is it possible that the engineering team was kind of like, you know,
we'll do one last Intel.
Yeah, and just sort of like not work super hard on it.
Because and by the way, everybody will go, oh, this thing sucks. So that when we come out with our, you know, our A15.
That's exactly right. That's,
they jump on it.
That's right.
I think you're exactly right,
Amy. And everybody say, like, you know what? We don't really miss the, like, the Intel thing makes sense now. We see that they're leaving. It's, you know.
You're exactly right. It's obvious. I don't know. The only thing I would maybe quibble with, I don't know if it'll be by as fast as 2020. It's a devilishly hard thing to do to make a processor that fast.
Everybody's working on their own silicon at the moment. So
I feel so bad for Intel. You know, Brian Krzanich, it's now obvious he didn't get fired because of his dalliances. He got fired because he screwed
up. That was a strange announcement, I thought.
It's like they said, to pay no attention to the fact that the company's falling apart. It's because he had sex with an underling. That's what it is. They'll eat this up. I can see it. I know the strategy meeting in the boardroom there with the PR people said, well, you know, if you said it was a sex scandal, they'd never report on this other stuff.
Divergence. Absolutely. So anyway, that's my crazy conspiracy theory, but I stand by it.
I mean, obviously, Intel is not in trouble. They're making money, like gobs of money. But it does feel like they've had some engineering challenges. They can't get to 10 nanometers, which is a big deal.
Well,
other companies can. Why can't Intel?
Well, Samsung's down to 7 nanometer.
Yeah.
TSMC? Like, so
why
the chips in your latest iPhone are all 7 nanometer, all those ARM CPUs.
So what's...
It's just they chose a different technology. So the actual material science behind it, Samsung went for a particular path and Intel went down another. They chose a different... the material.
Not the first time the Intel has gone down the wrong fork in the road.
No, they've done it before and managed to get away with it. However, the good news is that
Itanium never really did take off, did it?
Well, that wasn't a manufacturing process. That was a failure to read the market.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Itanium was doomed pretty much as soon as it hit the market. We all knew that. But I think the other side of it is that Intel's going to be fine. We saw in the last quarter, IDC announced the numbers.
PC sales are up.
PC sales are up 3%.
Not a lot. Not something to, you know, you're not going to eat cake, but at least you're not going to be sweating.
No. So there is some hope that Intel's got a buffer to be able to survive. But we are also seeing, like, for example, Broadcom has been growing strongly in recent years and making a number of acquisitions.
Making ARM processors.
Yep. And now we've seen them take over Computer Associates.
I think it'd be unfair to call what Apple's about to do an ARM processor, though. I know they have an ARM architectural license, but it seems to me Apple, custom silicon, one of the advantages Apple has is when they're designing the chips for their own hardware and their own use cases, they can optimize in ways that a general purpose chip just cannot.
I'm surprised it took them this long.
Yeah,
I mean, I know that it's like a like separate.
They wish they'd done it earlier. I guarantee you.
I mean, the other thing is they're also everybody's also producing their own silicon for AI, and their own frameworks.
Right.
So it just seems like this is a natural sort of next inflection point where everybody's moving toward. And I'm surprised it took this long.
You can see Apple sidling up to it, though. You're familiar with the T2 chip in the new MacBook.
Yes.
So that chip now has the NVMe bus.
Right.
It's now doing all of the crypto ops. It's now doing all a number of GPU ops.
It's a big reason why this is a faster computer is because a lot of that stuff's offloaded.
That's right. Memory handling, you know, there's a lot of stuff in that T2 chip. That's Apple sidling up to its own CPU.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that Apple will have its own, but my sense of it is that Apple's sidling up to this, you know, practicing, building. Apple never goes and does something in a big and commits the company to technology like that. But I could see the next MacBook Air being an ARM CPU. Not the MacBook Pros, not the MacBooks, but the ARM.
In a way, Microsoft's shifting towards that. You're seeing Windows on ARM.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the low end. I have an HP NVX2, which is a Windows 10 on ARM. Mm-hmm. It's a pig. It's really slow. But maybe the 845 will be a little faster. And there's some room there at the bottom
end. There's plenty of room in the ARM CPUs to improve the memory performance and the disk handling and the way that it transfers data between itself, like the NUMA architectures on board, how the if you have multiple threads, how the threads communicate with each other.
And then so I always felt like ARM was inherently going to be slower because of its choice of kind of a more of a RISC architecture, and that's just kind of the nature of the beast. Is that the case?
That's my sense of it. It'll always have less forward horsepower because it's just not clocking so fast.
Right.
Because they're focusing on power consumption.
But they're very efficient.
And thermal envelope, very efficient. Right. Hence the MacBook Air idea.
Start with an Air because it's a low-end consumer.
Start with an Air, it's low-end, too many promises, and then iterate for a few years.
Could you solve the problem the way Intel solved the problem with more cores? I mean, that's basically what Intel did, is said, well, we can't get them smaller, we can't get them faster, so let's just give you more of them.
Well, we can't. Yes, that's exactly where it's going to go.
What ARM
and
you're will do
have,
the same thing.
Going to have speculative thread execution, you know, and
that's what
and
got Intel in some trouble though with Spectre and Meltdown.
Those things can. That's because they're using speculative thread. They're pre-executing, but instead of having just six cores in like a hyper-threaded architecture, we've got six cores or 12 cores. Have 128.
Oh,
right. So we now have network adapters that go into desktops that have 128 ARM cores plus an FPGA and cost less than $1,000.
Really?
Right? Yeah, so if you're building a data center, like if I'm out working with a customer building a data center, we're putting smart NICs in that has 128-core ARM and an FPGA.
I guess we've seen that in GPUs as well, haven't we? They're many-core, multi-core GPUs.
And that also is the other place where there's so much room to be made from, and this is where Metal comes in, Apple's Metal. So you're now talking to an API.
They own the whole stack. They have it all.
Yeah, you talk to the Metal, and then what's the GPU underneath that?
Right.
You don't care.
You don't care.
They're going to optimize. And then they did the ARM thing, so we saw in the last keynote, they're starting to produce an ARM layer by bringing the apps from the iPhone to run on the Mac, just a small subset.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting.
And the T2 is an ARM chip.
Yep. Yes. Probably heading.
So in a way, this is a hybrid.
It'd be
already
more than an ARM. It would be an ARM with a bunch of other sub-processors. Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, they'd have things in the die like I.O. chips and memory bus handlers and so forth.
So basically what I bought, and I bought it for you, folks, because I wanted to test it so I could tell you, is an interim product. It's kind of the last gasp for Intel architecture. I bet you you're right on Mac OS, and they're putting it out for a high end audience that wants performance, understands a little bit that maybe you need something crazy like this eGPU, and yeah, it's going to cost you thousands of dollars. But for the main market, can they wait though? And I think that's probably what you were saying, Amy, was they just couldn't wait. They had to do something. But 2020.
Well, I think that there's also this, so this goes back to the incredibly smart point that Greg had made earlier, which is, you know, tech companies now are beholden to legacy capital in some way. And so I think there's this incredible pressure to keep putting something in to market, even though it may not be required or necessary, you know? So think
Apple's
of all the companies
been pretty
that are
resistant to that.
But
Mac Pro you're looking at hasn't been updated in 5 years.
Okay.
It's had minor tweaks.
The question is, did the new computer, like, did this stuff need to exist? And I don't know that the answer is yes. And if you look at all these different...
I think they felt a lot of pressure to...
Well, that's what I'm talking about, right? And if you look at a lot of different companies, including Microsoft, that are maybe late to the smart speaker market and are rushing to put out a smart speaker... You know, the question is does it make sense to focus on a smart, whatever it is, to let people know that you're still around, whatever, to appease expectations, which I realize is a core part of business, or to put those resources into building whatever's, you know, next. And I think that's how we wind up with a lot of sort of surprisingly bad technology.
Yeah. Look what Apple's done with the iPhone, though. They have stuck to a very consistent year-over-year schedule.
Yep.
Incremental improvements, yes, but in every case, something...
There's always
Well, that's a different model, though. That's a different model because people don't have to lease... You know, you're not paying a third party to use your laptop. So the phone doesn't work. And I think that that's... There's a core difference. And because none of us... Even, you know, I bought my phone outright. But essentially, I'm leasing a product.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The product is the ability for me to use mobile connectivity.
And in fact, there's good reason for them to do it yearly because people are on a 2-year contract. There's a turnover every year.
No, that's gone. The days of renting phones from carriers and telcos is pretty much over.
Well, I know they're not subsidized, but I still think that people expect to get a new phone every 2 years, whether they need one or not.
No.
No?
No. Fans incentivize you to pay monthly. When I broke my phone for the 15th time because these stupid Samsungs are made out of rice paper.
Yeah.
And the screens are constantly shattering. So I just tried to pay outright and it was impossible.
They want you to buy it month to month. Yeah.
No, they want you to pay a monthly fee. Yeah. I mean, they're essentially in the United States trying to nudge everybody
It's a compelling nudge because they say you only pay monthly and you get a new phone. When the new one comes out, you get a new one automatically.
Sure, but it also absolves the companies from making any significant improvements in their devices.
Servers put you at risk of that. Anytime you sign up for a subscription service, you're actually incentivizing the maker to not give you anything new.
Wait a minute. What?
Sales go down as a result.
Why is that? What?
So because...
they get an annuity. They get income. They're happy.
Whether they deliver something new or not.
Oh.
Right. So it's the same reason that we don't have 5G in a lot of places around the United States, because there's been no...
There's no competition.
We missed you being sarcastic with us, didn't we?
No, I wasn't being sarcastic. Well, I don't know what I was being.
It's not about... there is no 5G yet.
Stupid.
I want to come back. There is no 5G standard yet. That's still an evolving thing. That's why they're talking about 4.5G.
Disagree.
Does Japan have 5G?
Japan has put considerable resources into getting a 5G network completely up and running ahead of the Olympics.
Does 5G mean anything?
Yes, it does. Comcast will tell you no, and other providers in the United States will tell you no.
We should be honest. When AT&T and T-Mobile say, we've got 5G in New York City, that's not the same 5G Japan's putting in.
5G is a very loose collection of hundreds of possible different modes and operations. Some of them,
I think the name says it all. It stands for fifth generation.
Yeah, but it's,
right.
It's like LTE, long-term evolution. Yeah. I mean, these names kind of are giveaways.
Yeah, well, the 4G LTE was very much designed to do voice over and data to handsets.
Right.
5G is much more about building mobile broadband. So instead of running cable or fiber optic to the home, you can use the wireless spectrum to do it. They're also talking about being able to deploy microcells. So there's a whole bunch of standards
there
to do.
There's a huge issue though, because don't you need more sites? Lots more sites? And don't they all have to have high-speed backhauls?
Well, if you're doing mobile broadband, and that's a very high duty cycle, so it's consuming up the bandwidth, you need to be able to have a lot more spectrum available.
Right.
But there's no spectrum to have unless you turn off all of the analog TV stations.
This is where Japan has a huge advantage. Very dense population.
Very small.
And a sort of autocratic approach to technology.
And people
with the CDMA, like when I lived – when I was living there, there was like a question about CDMA versus – yeah, there was a question about standards.
Yes.
And because it's Japan, they just sort of decided that this is now what everybody is doing. And there wasn't a lot of political wrangling, and technology, as far as I'm concerned, in Japan is not politicized the way that it is in the U.S. So, you know, they are fully planning on deploying a fifth generation set of standards.
Yes. But there are many standards inside of 5G, and it's actually a lot of things. One of them is LoRa. And NB-IoT is extremely low powered, so you'll be able to use a little button battery to run a device for 10 years. Mm. Right? So that's not an iPhone.
That's for the IoT crowd.
That's for the IoT crowd. So instead of having this massive battery in here that has to be recharged every day, the current 4G standards are an attempt to be low power, but they're really not. So now we're seeing...
So we'll change our phones too?
Yes,
the bigger
absolutely.
Devices?
Well, potentially it'll be able to use less battery power, because if you're close to... it'll probably be unchanged. Smartphones will continue as is, maybe a little bit less power,
faster
for short bursts.
What it will do is help usher in glasses. So the models that we've built show that this is the beginning of the end of smartphones. So 2018, we've reached the apex, and it's all
It's not about IoT, it's about wearables.
It's also about things
information.
It's about wearables too, but it's also about autonomous cars carving out channels that work for it. So the actual 5G edge will be intelligently providing information to autonomous cars.
Flying cars. Because there's no 5G in tunnels under the ground. I'm just saying. All right, let's take a break. I love having Greg Farrow on from the Packet Pushers Network. It's great. Thank you for coming out here. Greg's normally based in the UK.
Yeah.
He's out here for something way over my head, but we just got him to come up. And Amy Webb, who has never been in our studio, will someday come visit us.
I will someday be there.
Please, because I want to meet you. But we love having you on, too. Are you in – I can never remember. You're in D.C.?
I'm in Baltimore today.
Balmer's
so
like
sometimes
DC.
I'm in New York. Sometimes I'm in Baltimore.
It's
today's
confusing.
Baltimore.
She's all over the place. She's a futurist. Her book, The Signals Are Talking, is a must-read. She was foolish enough to tell you how she does her craft, so you could be a futurist too. Even though I'm a little worried that we're talking to a futurist who says, I wouldn't want to see what it's going to be like in 20 years. That scares me.
I want to just put this out there because I know that I go dark quickly. So I'm a I'm a quantitative futurist. My job is to look at data and to model out risk and opportunity scenarios. And at the moment, most of what I see is risk. But that being said,
that's probably normal, right?
It's probably normal. I am an optimist. So I see doom, but I believe that we have the opportunity to create change, to make a better world.
If you were a futurist in 1929 or 1939, you would have been pretty bleak too. 1917.
That would have been, those were my people.
My peeps.
my people were the 1939 Industrial War Complex researchers.
They didn't want to go 20 years in the future either, but had they known, it would have been Dwight D. Eisenhower and the birth of the middle class. They would have said, hey, cool.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there are plenty of different ways to look at the present. And so not all is doom and gloom. What I'm mostly concerned about are the decisions that we are making. And I just feel like we're not always making decisions in the right way with the right amount of information.
Actually, I feel like we're not making decisions at all.
Sure.
That we're really deferring everything. We're kicking the can down the road. Nobody wants to be the one who said, hey, we got to tighten the belt. Hey, we got to cut emissions. Yeah. Hey, you can't get a Hummer.
And I think that is, to some extent, part of our American culture. We are nowists. We think very much about right now. In every part of our life, we are incentivized to work on short term, even if that means long term damage. And it's not like that in other places around the world.
Definitely not.
Scandinavian countries, parts of Europe, you know, they think
it's really hard.
Longer term.
One of the interesting things about living in England, like I grew up in Australia, which is like America, a relatively young country. But when you go to England and you, like my house that I used to live in was built in the 1750s.
What?
Right?
We didn't even have a country in the 1750s.
Exactly.
We were rebels.
It is certainly, if you live in Europe or around Northern Africa, it's very hard to have a short-term perspective. And I do think that's one of the great culture clashes between the US and Europe is Europe's got this sense of 1,000 years and America's got this sense of, you know, almost 100 years of history or something, you know, like.
Well, and then combine that with our fetishizing individualism versus collectivism.
Oh, don't start me on that.
That really is kind of a recipe for mindless hedonism because it's all about the individual's rights and the individual, what the individual wants.
Personal freedom versus societal
freedom.
But we masquerade. I think acknowledge that we feel very strongly that we have a good idea of what collectively those individuals should want. So I think we goad ourselves into thinking that we are, you know, planning for the what's best for the good of everybody when we really are using ourselves as the focal point. Leo, when you were in Japan, I'm off on a tangent. I'll stop momentarily.
No, I love it. Keep going.
When you were in Japan, a lot of those temples that you went into, most of the temples in Japan have a wood reserve. So whatever wood makes up the ceilings, somewhere there is a reserve pile of wood that has been, you know, if it's bamboo, it was likely planted by somebody, some monk who works there centuries ago, harvested by somebody 70 to 100 years ago. And then the labor of harvesting and prepping that wood and making sure that it would be, you know, sort of there at the ready when it was most needed was probably done by somebody who died like 50 years ago. And to me, that illustrates a core difference between how, especially in Asia, there's serious long-term thinking because that permeates throughout the government, tech, Sony, you know, like every major technology company in China, Korea, and Japan have very, very long-term plans that they allow to be sort of tweaked as time moves on. But, you know, it's a radically different way of thinking that we don't have in the United States. And the thing that concerns me is that we're the ones at the moment building the future. But we are doing so thinking squarely about the present.
Instead of having Louis the 13th cognac that takes 7 generations of winemakers to make over 100 years, we've got beer that's stale in 3 weeks.
Yeah, but
it's America.
Takes,
God bless it.
Yeah. I mean, the beer that I drink in the UK, for example, takes usually 4 to 6 weeks to make. But the lager
what
that
do you drink?
Here takes
Keep
3 days.
You got to tell us what you
Real ale.
What your...
I have a local bar near me that is real ale. It's called the Sanford Inn. The front bump, they have front pumps, and of the front beer pumps, there's only 8 of them. 3 of them are always the same, and the other 5 are always different. So every time I go into the pub, I get a different real beer, like real ale, not beer, but beer, not the stuff you get over here, which is
pretty good. Yeah, I've had your real ale, and I've had your real bangers and mash, too. Yeah. I don't...
If you come up to... You come up
I
to
don't know.
Town,
we got Lagunitas over here. They got we got real beer.
That
we,
stuff's manufactured to the point of like...
It's got yeast and mold and hops. It's all the same.
I want something that's made by one person in a building.
One person?
Yeah.
I was just in Ireland and went to the old Bushmills whiskey distillery because I'm a whiskey drinker. Yep. And I had some good whiskey there, but they were very, very insistent on like, this is the big difference between an Irish whiskey and a whiskey made somewhere else. And it's, you know, very few ingredients and
yeah, all that sort of stuff. Now I want to come back to one thing on the T2. We're talking about the T2 chip.
Hold on. Hold that thought.
All right.
We will come back to that and much more, including a $5 billion fine for Google in the European Union. But first, a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. I love Rocket Mortgage. They're geeks. They're geeks. Dan Gilbert and his crew are there at Quicken Loans. They love technology. They are very consumer focused in that kind of Silicon. They're in Detroit, but they're kind of that Silicon Valley way of really thinking about how can we serve our customers? And that's where they came up with Rocket Mortgage. They realized that the mortgage approval process was kind of stuck in the 19th century. You know, you had to go to a bank, you had to get paperwork and application. They made it all online. That was huge. They're always paying attention, though. And one of the things they've noticed is as interest rates are going up, we haven't seen interest rates go up in quite some time. They're going up now. And they realized, there's some anxiety to buying a home these days. Because as you're looking for a house, there's pressure. This is the most important decision you'll ever make, the biggest check you'll ever write. And there's this pressure to get it done now because interest rates are going up, but it's going to cost more next month. So they've come up with a great solution. They call it the power buying process. Here's how it works. You go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. As always with Rocket Mortgage, they'll verify your income and assets and credit. You don't have to get paperwork. You don't fill out an application. You just do it all online. They have trusted relationships with all the financial institutions. As soon as you give them permission, they get the information they need. It happens fast. No more than 24 hours to get you verified approval. Now, that's a big deal. The verified approval means you now are basically equivalent to a cash buyer. So when a seller's selling the house and they're talking to somebody with verified approval versus somebody that says, yeah, we're going to get the loan. We want this house. You've got the leg up by far. They know you're good for it. You've already got the loan, basically. Now, once you're verified, you qualify for the all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They will lock your rate up for up to 3 months. So no more anxiety about rates going up. Whatever rate you get when you go there, right, and go there now, right, rocketmortgage.com/twit2, that's your rate for up to 90 days. Oh, with one exception, if rates go down, your rate goes down. It just won't go up. So you win either way. It's exactly what you expect from America's best mortgage lender. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And now I'll give you the legal stuff. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, that one's important. Licensed in all 50 states, you bet. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Here's what you need to remember. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. It's the best way to get your new home or refi, too. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support. They've told us they're coming back next year. Thank you, Rocket Mortgage. And you know what? Thank you for supporting Rocket Mortgage. I've talked to a lot of you who've used Rocket Mortgage now. And we appreciate that. That helps Twit a lot. We're talking about the week's tech news. And we've got two of my favorite people to do it. And I think by now, if you're still listening, if you're not, you probably disagree. But if you're still listening, you agree that Greg Farrow from Packet Pushers Network and Amy Webb from The Signals Are Talking, amyweb.io, are really, I always feel smarter after these shows. So thank you. It's great to talk to you both. What did you want to say about the T2?
So T2 is kind of like
this is the little ARM chip that Apple started by putting in their what iPhone, right?
Yeah,
the T1.
Yep.
And they put it in the iMac Pro.
FaceTime and a few other fingerprint.
And now they put it in these new MacBook Pros.
It's a T2.
T2.
So Intel this week acquired a company called eASIC. So normally when you build processors, CPUs or ASICs, there's two types of ways of doing it. One is an ASIC where you fully design everything and then you hardwire everything and then you send it off to the factory.
These are widely used for Bitcoin miners, for instance, because you can make a very dedicated, very specific,
that's right.
Very
so a GPU chip is an instance of an ASIC.
Okay.
But ASICs are more general. So normally you have ASICs to do your NVMe controller or your memory controller.
They're very specific. In fact, that's what it stands for, application-specific.
Specific integrated circuit.
Right.
And at the other end, there's another type of chip called an FPGA, floating point gate array, which is a sort of an ASIC that has these programmable junctions which you can break or make.
Right.
And you can add them up. And you can actually load firmware into them to run general-purpose applications. We saw about a year ago there was a flash in the pan about putting FPGAs onto the servers so that the cloud companies could program in specific functions into the CPU. That doesn't seem to have picked up a lot of momentum. But these eASICs is somewhere in the middle. That is, they're actually ASICs that can have software loaded into them so that they can turn them into different things.
Oh, that's interesting.
So this is one ASIC. It's called a structured ASIC. So an ASIC takes about 18 months to bring to market from the time you start designing until you can go through the design phase, about 18 months. An FPGA is you can take an FPGA off the shelf and just start loading modules right into it, and you've got yourself in. And it's very complicated to make an FPGA program, I believe, so whatever. And these eASICs give you sort of like ASIC capabilities, but in a 3 to 6 month timeline. And this is where the T2 is it's kind of a chip that allows you to be reprogrammed. You load an app into it and it runs a touch bar. Or you load an app into it, turn it NVMe or a crypto processor or a
drive controller or a RAM controller.
Yep.
So you can get these very specific, highly optimized, customized tasks.
Yes, but from a single chip.
From one chip.
Without doing a whole lot of redesign.
So the T2 is running new software all the time, or is it pre-programmed from the factory?
It's a little hard. We don't know. I think the T2 is much more of a programmable, like this structured ASIC. Yeah. I'll put a link into the chat room.
Okay.
And I'll send it'll be in the show notes if you want to read up more about it. But I think this is Intel realizing that this is the new future, this dedicated ASIC. But people don't want to build custom ASICs for everything and go through a 2-year cycle. There has to be a middle ground.
Does it replace the CPU, or do we still have to have this general purpose brain?
And I wanted to know, does that mean it's complementary or competitive with edge computing then?
I see it as complementary in the sense that these processors will run alongside CPUs, but you'll be able to use them for dedicated tasks. So you'll still have the CPU somewhere.
The T2 is exactly that. The T2 does everything from the secure enclave to fingerprint to it's got a DSP for FaceTime.
Yep, that's right.
But you still have an Intel i7 or i5 or i9
yep.
That's doing the general
that's
purpose
doing the general purpose stuff.
Computation.
And I think we're seeing, you know, we're already seeing this ability. Like the CPU's reached its maximum capability. We can't clock them faster. We can't make them bigger. We're struggling to make them smaller. So the way that we do things is we offload functions to GPUs. We have network adapters. Yeah. We have memory controls.
Is that what you mean by edge computing, Amy?
So the idea is that the source of the data and the application that the data uses are closer together. It's a divergence from the John von Neumann architecture. We may be talking about things in parallel, but...
Yeah, edge is a way to bring processing to the edge. So the idea is that the network only has finite
smart bandwidth. Devices as opposed to a centralized
that's right. So, brain. You know,
this has been the evolution of computing.
It reduces latency.
It's been the evolution of computing from the 50s where you had a mainframe and terminals. Then we had client-server computing.
That's the Von Neumann
computing.
Architecture, right? Yes. And that hasn't changed at all. So this is sort of the next architectural approach.
Edge computing is much more likely to be aligned very closely with a central function. So the central function will have very tight control over it. And it will have apps and software.
So you still have a master control unit.
Yeah, that's right.
Without the MCU.
Yeah, we used to call them master slave. We're not allowed to say that so much these days. But there has to be a master and uncontrolled edge. So instead of the edge being what it is today, your laptop, which is you can put anything on it and you have control of it, the edge in the future will be much more like this. Much restricted and administered from a central control point. And you'll also see it. You know the little green boxes on the side of the road as you walk around? You'll be seeing those, instead of a mobile phone tower having a bunch of analog equipment driving it, it'll just be a bunch of x86 servers, and the apps will be deployed from somewhere in the central of the cloud. That's how I see the edge. Or, you know, cars will be little mini data centers. That will be your edge.
That isn't going to do you any good. I'm afraid. Stop. Please. You realize I cannot allow this. I'd like to go against you and see what you're made of. I'm warning you. You're entering a big error. I'm going to have to put you in the game grid.
That's the voice.
That's the voice of master control. You're going to be troubled now with DRM, aren't you?
I'm sorry. I live in science fiction. I'm not in the
real Tron's world. One of my favorite movies ever.
Is it?
You have such
poor taste. What? No. Why is it one of your favorite movies? With Jeff Bridges Tron. The young Jeff Bridges Tron, not the old Jeff Bridges Tron.
Original Tron.
Yeah, the original
not
Tron.
Whatever happened.
Whatever that was.
Yeah.
The one with the flying, with the frisbee.
Original, very cool, retro, colorful, interesting, so inside the machine.
Did you get chills when I played the voice of Master Control? Did that bring back your childhood?
It did.
Yeah.
I got a little excited.
This is the voice of Master Control. I think we'll find some... it's funny how... I actually, one of the things I love about Twit and about what we do and what I do is that it ranges everywhere from the functions of ASICs and FPGAs to the politics of the European Union and everywhere in between. And that's really how technology has permeated our world. The EU has decided that Google has violated antitrust regulations because of how it handles Android and has fined Google $5 billion. Well, it's 4.2 million euros, so whatever that is in dollars. And says you have 90 days to knock it off. Now, I bet you both have strong opinions about this.
I wouldn't say strong opinions.
Opinion at all? Any opinion?
Yeah, a little bit. I think you could say lots and lots of things about this, but I think the first of all is the gap between U.S. anti-competitive or U.S. antitrust and the vision that Europeans have of antitrust.
So tell me how we diverge.
So the way that I understand U.S. antitrust, obviously, is that it's focused on whether the consumer is affected financially.
It's to protect consumers, basically.
Yeah, both antitrust laws are to protect consumers, but the U.S. is purely focused on whether the consumer has been suffered financially. So did it cost you more? Did they get together and do something to charge you more for a product that could have been cheaper?
Okay.
And in this case, Android is free. So there will never be an antitrust against Google around this because the antitrust law is clear. There has to be a monetary problem here. The consumer has to be protected, but only financially, not emotionally or morally.
How is it different in the EU?
In the EU, they take a much more systemic view of the place, and they say if you're controlling the market in any form, monetarily, societally, you know, or dominating the market by making, you know, so even if Google gives away Android for free, you can still be abusing the market.
So
even if the consumer gets the benefit of having your product for free.
You used to be in the EU, now you're in Britain, but
we haven't left yet.
I've heard it a little differently, but maybe this is the same thing, that in the US antitrust laws is designed to protect consumers, in the EU antitrust laws are designed to protect competition amongst companies.
Yes.
To keep it a competitive environment for companies.
And that's a moral dimension or a political dimension in that any company should be able to enter the market. So this is where Google
and ultimately Facebook, consumers benefit from that.
And this is where Google and Facebook can be so dominant. It's because there's no way anybody can enter the market because they're giving it away for free. Does that make sense?
Yeah, except this. Well, the reason it bothers me. So there's three different areas that the EU is upset about. One is that Google bundles Chrome and the Play Store into Android.
Yep.
Two is that they pressure companies that are selling Android devices to pick either the free Android, which has no Google services, or the Google services Android.
Yep.
You can't do both. And the third problem, which has somewhat gone away because Google stopped doing this practice in 2014, they pay some companies more than other companies. They give companies sweetheart deals for Android, things like that. It strikes me that if you want to talk anti-competitive, look at the iPhone. There's no free version of the iPhone. They bundle whatever the hell they want into it. You have to use the Apple Store. You have to, if you're a developer, you have to give Apple 30% of your revenue, period.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no other companies making Apple phones. Only Apple can make an Apple phone.
Right.
On the other hand, you have Android, which is free and open source. Anybody, including Amazon, a deadly competitor to Google, makes an Android device by forking Android, and they pay Google nothing to do it. Google, I think, seems to me as being really I like it there. It's open source. They've given away an operating system. There are more than 1,000 Android phone manufacturers. They get to choose what they want to do. Do they want the Google services? If they choose the Google services, it's because their customers say, I don't want an Android phone that doesn't have Google Play Store and Chrome on it. So it seems to me Google's being the good guy here. And that's Sundar Pichai's contention. He says Google and Android have created more choice. He's the CEO of Google, not less. Okay, sorry, Amy. Go ahead. What do you think?
No. Well, so this is where, because I agree, I agree with you, but this is also where our lawmakers, again, not thinking about the future and the laws that they create, run counter to the practical realities of the technology and the ecosystems that the technology relies on. So Apple is a completely closed environment, and because it's a proprietary closed environment, and you are buying a thing that closed environment operates under, you know, somehow they don't rise to the level of antitrust.
Well, and to be fair, in the EU, they're only 25% of the market. Here in the United States,
sure,
Apple's half the
market. And that ultimately, that's it. It finishes there, right? Apple is not a monopolistic,
right?
You know, or is
because
not.
But here's the thing. Yep. But here's the thing. Because, again, like, so my area of research is artificial intelligence. And, you know, so Google is constantly making its platform open. Anybody can build on it. So TensorFlow is out there. It's their framework. Anybody can build on it and do whatever they want. And TensorFlow is a big chunk of GitHub. But GitHub is owned by Microsoft, and TensorFlow, in order to basically, there's just like a limited number of frameworks and a limited number of training sets and algorithms that are, you know, practically in use anyways. And so I think that the better conversation to be having right now is, what does antitrust mean in an age in which platforms, you know, antitrust makes a lot of sense when you're talking about hamburgers. It makes a lot less sense when you're talking about very, very sophisticated, complicated technologies that are layered. Mm-hmm. You might draw the parallel, like when Microsoft got into trouble with Explorer, yep. If you remember a long time ago.
Yeah, but again, Microsoft was the dominant provider. They had 80% or 90% of the desktop market, and politicians and politics generally, or societal moves, are focused on the number of people impacted.
So what you're really saying is that the thing the EU doesn't like is Google's just too damn big.
Now, in this particular case, this is where the law starts, the actual practical law. Law says the number of people impacted. Apple might make 80%.
It's true, by the way, in the United States, that you're not subject to antitrust law if you don't have a dominant position, if you don't have a monopoly position. It's the same thing here. You have to be big enough.
You have to be big enough, have a significant percentage of the market per person.
Yeah.
So in the U.S., the monopoly condition only comes in when the consumer suffers financial loss. The EU law says we must allow new companies to emerge. That is, if somebody wants to enter this market, they must be able to unseat the dominant player through fair and reasonable competition.
So that's what you're saying, Amy, is because they're platforms, it doesn't make sense at this point to say that somebody should come along and unseat Google. That doesn't even make sense.
What I'm saying is that the EU, I think, is very prescient when it is thinking about the future of data and technology and people. You know, don't forget they had a 1990. They were early in the days of the internet with a very, very early data protection that launched in 1995.
And I think on balance, we've concluded GDPR has been a benefit for everybody in the world.
I would disagree.
Oh,
because there are plenty of legitimate news websites with legit, like the Chicago Tribune, which couldn't be seen in areas around Europe. And
it's because they're dopey.
Well,
so what?
Yes and no.
So what? Who cares, right? If it's a Chicago Tribune and they don't want to show their content in Europe, so what?
Because it creates a fragmented information space.
We've already got a fragmented
information space. That's a bad thing. I agree.
We've already have a fragmented information space. It's called Google. He who ranks first wins. Everybody else loses. Okay.
But the problem is their IP is being blocked and you're not getting in there through a side door. You are going there directly outside of search. The problem that I have is that, you know, I've been talking a lot about the emergence of splinter nets. Mm-hmm. We have a fractured, splintered internet.
We don't want that,
but we're already seeing that. So
And frankly, we're seeing it because Facebook is the internet for, seems to be the internet for a lot of people.
Sure, we're seeing that in lots of different places. And right. within the EU, the GDPR is being implemented differently depending on the local regulators.
Right.
But here's the thing with the antitrust suit and the massive fine, and with Google. The problem is the intent of the laws, I think, makes sense. It's the execution and implementation because you have to have something executable, which means you've got to be thinking about what can we do right now. Mm-hmm. Is where the problems are,
It also has to be said that Google had plenty of chance to make not let this happen. So it was
what
was coming.
Supposed to do?
Google chose to be in this position.
So what was Google's fork? What could they have done?
They could have been, the European Commission told them very clearly, you need to do these things. It refused to
be less successful.
No, it was told that it had to share access to its platform, allow other search engines to emulate. They knew that from the Microsoft. Remember the Bing thing on top of the Microsoft?
Again, I would point out on the iPhone.
It's not like the competition wasn't telegraphed to them. It wasn't like, slap, here's a fine. They've been told for 5 years that if they didn't do something.
I can't replace Safari as default browser. I can't replace Springboard as default launcher. No, the default is always Safari on iPhone. On Android, I can have it be Microsoft's launcher.
Yep.
I can have it the Edge browser. I can have Bing be the search. It's a trivially easy thing to do. In fact, Sundar Pichai on his blog post shows how you could do that in under 25 seconds.
So I dropped out of law school before I started, so I am not speaking with any legal authority.
Wait a minute, you can't drop out of something before you started.
I made an alternate decision not to go.
So you got in and you were going to go and then you said, oh, screw it.
It was a weird moment in my life that I, yes.
No, and you're not regretting that one bit, Amy Webb.
Not at all. I would have been a horrible lawyer.
The happiest lawyers I know are lapsed lawyers.
Yeah, it would have not been good for everybody. But my point is, this is, again, so like the law, I understand intent, but the way that when you're dealing with legal frameworks, you have to have stuff in writing. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that the stuff in writing applies in a meaningful way to Google. Apple, it doesn't. And even though Apple, I would argue, is violating the spirit of the law, not Google.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So the problem is in implementation. And the problem is by the time that the moment to fine rolls around, you've got too many people making decisions and nobody looking at the farther term
Well, and that is what we saw with Microsoft, is that by the time this whole process finished, it was over anyway.
So the commission's moved a lot faster. But my point is, Google chose to be in breach of the law here. The law, the European Commission told them long before.
So answer Amy's question. What path should Google have gone down?
Google is the dominant player. The law is clear that they have to share access to their platform in
this
circumstance.
What does that mean? I mean,
Apple,
if you're giving away Android.
You can't say Apple should do this too, because it is not the dominant player. Apple has carefully judged its sense in the market. It does not want to ever be the majority supplier of handsets. And so you don't have to go and open up your platform if you choose to be 25% of the market.
But I guess Google's platform not open? What do you want, source code?
The dominant player, the rules are different.
So what should they do that's
What's
different?
So wrong about that, right? Just because so you can, if you're you can, the 75%
I guess
market
what I'm saying is, like, again, so like, and believe me, mm-hmm. I don't like what I'm seeing Google do in a lot of different spaces, but in this particular case.
We're not saying Google's perfect by any means.
No, but in this particular case, I don't understand how they could have remedied the
say any handset maker who wants to put the Play Store and Chrome on their handsets, go have at it. You're welcome to do so.
And then go and build another operating system like the one they're building. I can't remember the name
Fuchsia.
Of it. Fuchsia. And maybe that's a different one that's closed, but it'll actually have a different set of market share. So it would be
As of now, Fuchsia's open.
Yeah. Maybe it won't be in the future in reaction to this.
Does duck.com work on it?
Yeah. But the point is that, Google's been slapped with a $5 billion fine that they chose to take rather than to fit
in.
Well,
no, they're appealing this.
Yeah, they'll appeal it, but it's still less than 5% of
you
cash
You say they
on
chose
hand.
By their actions rather than...
They're saying, what they're effectively saying by never having fixed that before today is that the $5 billion is worth it.
They're making more than $5 billion. It's probably in Google's interest to give away the Play Store, which they make money on, and the Chrome browser, which they make money on.
You could make the case that the Play Store is necessary to secure Android. People should not be able... The success of Apple's phone has been the App Store and the fact that apps are safe, malware-free. The Android is a is a train smash of a security app. Everything on, you can't find an Android phone that's basically not malware.
If Google had closed sourced Android and made themselves, like Apple, the only maker of Android handsets, would that have been compliant?
Who knows?
Would the world be a better place with 800,000 Symbian phones?
So the question more likely is, if Google had have closed sourced it, would we see other operating systems from companies like Samsung?
Yeah, Tizen.
There would be more platforms in the market.
Yeah, Tizen.
Symbian. Maybe. What about Palm OS?
Palm OS.
What about QNX from like the BlackBerry operating system? Yeah. What about all the others?
Great winners they in the marketplace of ideas.
And they were all killed because Google gave
away
Android.
No, they were killed because they sucked.
I would agree. I don't think they
were killed because Android was free. Microsoft Windows tried to license its operating system.
You have a point.
BlackBerry tried to license its operating system. Palm OS was trying to be
Microsoft
licensed.
Microsoft killed Netscape by giving away Internet Explorer.
Yes.
So that's a kind of dumping.
Yep.
So that may be a point. So you say Google extinguished made Android all of its free by dumping Android.
So once it killed all of its competitors, it's now the dominant player, and it now dictates to people what can happen on Android. That is a monopolist position. Right? And all the other platforms were extinguished.
That's a very good point.
Sure. No, I concur.
And effectively, Google has said $5 billion against a known thing that's coming. That's worth doing. I'm making more than $5 billion.
Their plan was, we found this open source, which they didn't write, by the way, this open source Andy Rubin's open source operating system for phones called Android. They bought it.
Yep.
They said, you know what would be cool?
We could use this to generate more ad revenue.
If we dumped this and made it on every phone possible, and it is totally dominant globally except in the U.S., then nobody would...
No, it is now. It's 60% of the U.S. market.
Even in the U.S.? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Then no one will write anything to compete with us.
You can't.
And then
who else is going to spend $1 billion writing a smartphone operating system?
Okay, so again, then that to me... So, like, I get the intent... But I this is where I think our legal frameworks and our expectations for how our open markets work don't mesh with the realities of everyday practical use. So
what Google has to do, what the European Commission wants
today,
is for Google.
Go ahead, Amy.
So you know, we can't on the one hand bitch at Google for keeping its stuff under lock and key, and then also bitch at them for making it open. And I realize that incentivizes others away from creating their own systems because one exists that's superior, mm-hmm. and it's being given away for free. But then what would be the next option?
Google abused its monopolistic position to give away its operating system to extinguish all competition.
Once
it had extinguished the competition, it then abused its dominant power to force to make money.
Next best choice is to not make as much money. And no company is designed to make that choice.
So these steps are designed to allow another competitor to enter the market. Now,
we
can't replace Android, so they have to open up their platform so that other companies can enter the market and through browsers or ads or apps or whatever. And Google knew it was coming, and they can't whine and go, you hurt me, because they knew it was coming.
I guess
it was always going to come since 1995, because this is exactly the Microsoft Windows search engine
model.
And browser and the whole thing all over again. You know, the 1995 95 Internet Explorer.
I think actually you've convinced me.
Yeah.
Interesting. On the other hand, the eggs are cracked. There's nothing we can do to put the egg back in the shell.
No.
Fuchsia, I wonder what the plan is then for Fuchsia. It sounds like what the Fuchsia team, which, by the way, is now 100 engineers strong. This is Google's new one operating system to rule them all.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like their plan is to literally make this operating system run phones, IoT devices, smart speakers, even Chromebooks. This is the single operating system of the future.
Mm-hmm.
It is currently open source. In fact, people have contributed to it, which means I think it kind of has to stay open source. Is that going to be dumped on the world and then Microsoft Windows and Mac OS go away and everybody uses Fuchsia and then Google dominates?
Who knows?
Total world global
Still
domination.
Still too early to tell. I mean, how many companies can afford to put hundreds of engineers on a project for year in, year out?
So then we ought to be asking the question right now,
mm-hmm.
Does that run afoul of antitrust
only
policies? Well, But again, like, so I get
this
that
is
we
part
want
of the problem is that all of this stuff is reactionary instead of
correct.
Pro
all law is reactionary.
Yeah.
All law is reactionary.
You can't predict prior to be prior restraint.
Well, the enforcement of that law is reactionary. The development of the law ought to be using strategic foresight and thinking about how it might be, you know,
it's hard to do, though, when applied. A company is willing to eat a $5 billion fine. It's kind of hard to think of something you could do to discourage
and so that,
behavior.
My point is, like, the EU had to have known that. They had to have known that. So what's the, you know.
It takes time for the wheels to turn, and the law always reacts. I mean, technology moves so much faster than the legal environment framework can. So
this is why Amy doesn't want to live in 20 years in the future. It's going to be dominated by fuchsia.
And
it's a hideous color.
The interesting corollary here is that if Apple does get to be more than 50% of handsets in Europe, it will have a problem.
Maybe that's why they're not trying to. Maybe they'd you know, it's actually a smart strategy. We'll just skim the cream. We'll cream the skim.
Yes.
There's two different meanings there. We'll skim the cream and just make a high-end device that has high profit, sell it to a minority of users.
Apple is not preventing other people from entering the market, where in this case, Google clearly is because they're giving away their operating system for free.
Couldn't you have made the same argument about BlackBerry 10 years ago? BlackBerry had 98% global market share. BlackBerry had, because of its security features, overwhelmingly the federal contracts. I mean, nobody else could compete against BlackBerry. Did BlackBerry face similar antitrust lawsuits and arguments?
I don't know, but I suspect they would have eventually.
It was too quick.
But they were
it was over before it started.
Yeah.
Well, but it wasn't though.
But at the same time, we also had Nokia handsets. Everybody else had their own operating systems. It wasn't like you had to buy BlackBerry.
Nokia was actually far more dominant.
That's right.
So here's what I'm getting at, because I actually disagree. I think that if you wanted to do a certain kind of business, you had to have a BlackBerry because of the security protocols. Yeah. So here's what I'm getting at. I think a lot of regulators and companies and countries around the world don't like Google. I think that they don't like...
Isn't it funny how Silicon Valley gets all whiny when they don't get loved?
Well,
I mean, they're doing this for us.
What? Who?
Google's doing...
They're doing
all
it because they
want to do
us.
Is put the world's information at your fingertips. Right. What's so wrong about that?
Yeah.
I think, again, that there's got to be a way going forward for us to think about what's best for us, for humanity, right, in a real sense, and to somehow depoliticize the regulatory framework of technology.
This isn't political. This was been coming for 10 years.
This is like World Cup level.
This has been
like,
through multiple governments. This court case has existed across multiple.
I think you're right, Amy, but I think I think the only reason you think that's even possible is because you lived in Japan for so long.
Google was really excited 2 years
ago.
It doesn't
seem like that could ever happen, right?
Google was really excited 2 years ago when the European Commissioner for Justice actually changed. They thought they were going to get away with it.
They got Margaret Vestager instead.
Yeah, and she went after them.
But at the same time, the EU
there's no politics here. This is the law.
Hang on, dude. At the same time, the EU Parliament is trying to introduce legislation that would
Article
regulate
13.
Robots. Yeah.
Oh,
right?
Ooh, I didn't know about that one.
Yes.
And at the same time, we've got the U.S. government legislating that all data in any American company in the whole world belongs to the U.S. government.
So let me come back to the robots for a moment. The reason that is short-sighted, because robots are containers. They are containers for code that works inside them and on behalf of them and for other things. So the problem is that we've got, to some extent, a fundamental misunderstanding of how a lot of different technologies work. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this has become politicized in a way that doesn't make sense. And I'm usually not defending Google, but I think in this particular case, the EU has a history of politicizing technology, misunderstanding the implications of that technology, and like writing weird laws.
That is not unreasonable.
I don't think it's unreasonable for the EU to at least contemplate a law of robotics. It's not yet codified, but it's not. Is it a bad thing to think about? This is what they. This is from CBIT. EU delegate Maddie Delvaux reports the commission is currently working on EU-wide laws of robotics. One option to be to assign robots the status of electronic personality for damage compensation. So if your autonomous vehicle runs over somebody, the robot is responsible. The other thing they're considering is mandating a kill switch for robots.
This sounds exactly like laws around cars, another technology.
Well,
you've got to have
exactly
a license to drive a car, and the car has to be safe. And if you run into somebody who's legally responsible, there's no difference between this and laws around cars.
I think it's an appropriate thing to consider. Go ahead, Amy.
Well, there is a pretty big difference because nowhere in that proposal are they defining, you know, where the chain of custody is. So are we, is it the person who created the algorithm, the person who created the malware, the person, you know, these are the problems that I'm talking about.
Again, and same with the car. The manufacturer has a responsibility to make the car, but the person for driving it is responsible for the results of their actions when driving the car. If the car manufacturer creates a faulty petrol tank and it blows up, they're responsible.
Well, let's point out.
There's no difference here. But we're talking about intellectual property. And the problem with intellectual property is that we have radically different viewpoints on it depending on where in the world you are. And the bigger problem is that is globalization. So everybody's doing business with everybody else, and the intellectual property laws don't even come close to meshing.
Well, WIPO's trying to fix that. And what they're going to make it the U.S. law. That's the law. That's the IP law. This is interesting. So I should point out they're considering, they're talking. This is the beginning stages. There's no law yet, and this is a good time to weigh in if you're a roboticist on what these laws should be. They have apparently agreed on what makes a robot. You want to know?
Let's hear it.
There's five things. The acquisition of autonomy through sensors or by exchanging data with its environment and trading and analyzing of that data. So it's an autonomous device. It's not a remote control.
Unlike controlled. A car, which is a controlled.
It's not remote control. It's not, Number two, and this is an optional criterion, self-learning from experience and by interaction, machine learning. Number three, at least a minor physical support. That's to distinguish a robot from, say, software. Mm-hmm. Has to be something physical.
Yep.
The adaptation of its behavior and actions to the environment. That's kind of like...
In other words, it has a feedback loop.
Yeah.
If something goes wrong, it's self-adapting.
And the absence of life in the biological sense.
Right. And so, again, the thing that we should be concerned about is recursive self-improvement. The thing that we should be concerned about are... genetic algorithms that have the ability to, that have heritability.
Right.
The thing that I am not concerned about is the cool, Asimo looking robot, and whether or not it has a kill switch.
Right.
So again, you got to think this stuff through. And I understand that the piece of this that's tangible for us is, Google Chrome is the car. Is the robot, but there are issues here that are far more sophisticated than a quick update to Asimov's three laws of robotics plus the zeroth law.
I hope they're acting that way.
I mean, it's
at least
not like they're about to.
God bless them. They didn't just say, "Hey, let's just use Asimov's law; those are good enough." And I mean,
but I've seen people do that.
I know.
Even Asimov said
that these laws are logically.
It was part of a short science fiction story he wrote. He published in a magazine.
They're logically inconsistent. They don't even. You couldn't anyway. Yeah.
This isn't law. This is announcing that things. It's a bit like this court case that Google has just.
Everybody
lost.
Has said that that we should be thinking about
it's years.
This
it's
now.
Been 10 years in the making, right? It's not like
But the lawsuit is important. The outcome of that lawsuit is important. Whether or not Google pays is important. These crazy laws of robotics that use important because it becomes part of that conversation and ultimately the layer cake that makes up our incredibly convoluted legal frameworks that govern everything from technology to commerce to human rights and liberties as they relate to technology. So the stuff is important.
Oh, I agree. I think we're all in agreement on that.
Yeah, but at least we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Like at least the EU's taken a position and opened it up for discussion.
Well, and the EU's talking about it. Is there a process for feedback or request for comments, anything like that? I wonder.
Sure.
Or they just sit in a room somewhere in a mountain in Switzerland.
Anybody can go and participate.
Actually, they're not in Switzerland.
Make submissions to your MEP and away you go.
You know, living in Brussels for any length of time would make anybody crazy. No, I'm just kidding. They got good beer and chocolate. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. One place you don't have to go anymore if you are a Stamps.com customer, the post office. Nothing wrong with it. I love the post office. I love my mailman. But wouldn't it be cool if you could buy and print postage from your desk with your computer, your printer? We're not talking postage meter. You got everything you need already. No special ink, no special hardware, just your printer, your computer. In fact, with Stamps.com, you can access all the amazing services of the post office right from your desk, 24/7, when it's convenient for you. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer, and then the mail carrier comes and picks it up. I was at the post office the other day. All I wanted to do, I had a package. All I wanted to do, they have this new kiosk, no human, and I there was a little bit of a line, so I didn't want to wait there. So I went to the kiosk, and there's some woman. All I wanted to do was I had one thing I wanted to print a stamp for and mail it. She had a stack this tall of manila envelopes. She was obviously doing some sort of business. Was there for half an hour, weighing, pressing buttons. I almost came up to her and said, you know, if you went to stamps.com and used the offer code TWIT, you could do all this at your desk in minutes. No equipment, no long-term commitments. They even will send you a digital scale that automatically calculates the exact postage. They'll help you decide the best class of mail every time. You don't have to type anything in. They'll take the address from the address book or the, you know, if you're an Amazon seller, Etsy, eBay seller, it'll just get it from the website. It gets your return address. It can put your logo on there. Click print mail. You're done. It could not be easier. We use it. Highly recommend it. If you do any kind of mailing, but especially if you're a seller, it's so, you know, the impression that you make is so important. Stamps.com really makes you look like a pro organization. That's some of the biggest companies in the world use Stamps.com. You should too. Go to Stamps.com. You can do like we do, enjoy the Stamps.com service. We've got a special offer. It includes up to $55 free postage, that digital scale I mentioned. You get a four-week trial. Did you hear what I just said? I'm giving you $55 in free postage here, folks. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIT. Stamps.com, offer code TWIT. Man, I don't know why. I should have just gone up to that lady. I said, man, I could help you, and you could help me. Stamps.com, offer code TWIT. Actually, Leo, you should have just come to work and used the Stamps.com thing. What was I thinking? No, you know, I still have a post office box, so I like to go in there once in a while, and I like the mail people.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I used to have one of those. I used to really enjoy going to the P.O. box.
You did? Are you being facetious?
No, I used to.
It's fun. You have the key.
You go in.
Special key says U.S. government property. Yeah. Do not duplicate.
And I used to be able to ignore my mail. That was awesome.
Well, you know what's really
sad? You enjoyed going to the post office? Did I get that right?
Yeah, when I lived.
What planet are you from?
No, it's fun. Post office is WPA era. It's got murals, beautiful old brass boxes. Yep. I think some of the mail workers are actually as old as the building.
Yeah.
And you go in there.
I knew my mail guy. He was a really nice
guy. Awesome. Yeah. I love mail carriers. Yeah. And then you go in and you have this really old key and you open the box.
Yeah.
Now, what's really sad, I'm really sad, is the only way the Postal Service continues is by junk mail. So my box is loaded, and they even know this because there's the box, there's the table, there's the recycling bin. You just take the stuff out of the box, put it on the table, throw it in the recycling bin. For all I know, they take the recycling bin, put it back in the box. It reminds me, I went, speaking of Mao, because you said you were a Maoist, right, Amy?
No, I did not.
You said you were a Maoist. For a minute, I heard
in
Maoist.
In fact, I've been censored in China, I found out.
What?
So no, I'm not a Maoist.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
What? Why?
Well, you're lucky.
Because of the insights that I have shared about why China is doing what it's doing with AI and how it's collaborating and the book that I'm writing now that's coming out soon is the story of the United States and China and AI. And
oh, get us banned. We'd like to be banned in China, too. Tell us all. First of all, and I think, you know, I've said this before and I've been laughed at, mocked, especially by people who know about China. I feel like, you know, the 20th century was the American century. I think we all agree.
Yep.
I feel like the 21st century is the Chinese century.
Absolutely.
Yep.
There's no question in my mind. Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
China,
I agree with Amy. It's
like
because of long-term thinking. The Chinese are taking 25-year and 50-year perspectives, while the Western societies are looking at things quarter by quarter or maybe for as long as 3 years of a democracy.
So fill us in, though, Amy. What are they thinking? What's the plan?
So this would take a little while to explain. But
the plan they don't want anybody in China to know about.
I don't know. The plan's been around since 1949.
But they're banning you, so you must have said something they didn't like.
You know, my perspective on this is that she's like, so there is a president now in power effectively for life.
Yeah.
That
was kind of shocking when she did that. I thought that was not.
So Xi Jinping is president for life. There are a number of different, he is a stalwart within the party. He is beloved within the party.
Is he a kind of old school communist?
Very old school. There are a number of initiatives, but he's very smart because he understands how to be on a public stage. So he is sort of the opposite of being sort of isolationist. And there are a number of initiatives. The Belt and Road Initiative is sort of being pitched as an infrastructure product.
That's project. Kind of interesting. You go to Beijing and they have these belt roads all the way around in concentric circles.
This is a little different than, so this is like getting the,
is that what they're doing or is something else?
No, it's sort of being described as an infrastructure and trade along what used to be the old Silk Road. However, a lot of the pilot companies, the 68 pilot companies, many of which are in Africa and spread out around, that have signed up for this are getting an export of, China's social credit score pilot system. A lot of China's surveillance methods, you know, so from my vantage point, China is spreading its brand of social capitalism or not capitalism, sorry, its brand of communism.
Surveillance communism.
You know,
authoritarian communism.
In a way to me that is breathtaking. And because it's autocratic, I mean, there are sweeping changes sort of being pushed through. So for everybody who looks at China and says, whatever, they've tried stuff before, this is copy-paste culture, right? That's what they're good at, copy-paste. They are missing an entirely different story that's unfolding in front of our very eyes, which is that China has very much transformed from copy-paste to, you know, innovating and spreading some radical ideas in ways that I think we're all going to find very uncomfortable if we don't do something about it. So,
wow. So yeah. What's the name of the book and when's it come out?
The name of the book is The Big Nine. The Big Nine refer to the nine companies that control the future of artificial intelligence. Six are in the United States, three are in China. And it comes out early next year.
Can't wait.
And it's already been banned in China. So there you go.
They haven't even read it.
They bought out the contract. A publisher there forked out over quite a bit of money in order to bury the book.
Oh.
So, and we didn't know that at the time. So my publisher now is dealing with the, you know,
that's what the National Enquirer does, right? What is it called? Capture and catch and catch and
something
hold? Catch and hold journalism?
Catch
and bury?
Keep what you kill.
Keep what you kill? wow, that's interesting. Well, I can't wait to read that. We'll have you on when the book comes out, and we could spend an hour or two talking about it on triangulation. That sounds really, really interesting.
And it's really, really, for me, this is one of those sort of big stories that gets overlooked a lot, which is unfortunate. It means that we're stuck in the weeds paying attention to, I think, the wrong things too often. Yeah. So
you mean in the U.S. or?
Just in general. You know, like the Amazon, you know, Amazon's store going down during Prime Day.
That's a big story. Like, I was just about to talk about
is
that.
Is it though? Yeah, I mean, I know. That's why I sort of segued.
No, I'm not. Like, actually, I was actually literally, as you said, that scrolling past it, so we didn't have to talk about it.
Okay.
But it is like, on the rundown, but we put everything on there.
So here's something I find interesting. So the two things happened last week. So the Amazon store went down during Prime Day, and everybody talked about it, I think, in part because of the visuals. So, right, like, you were getting pictures of people, and it was, like, funny to talk about. Right. There's another story that was equally, I think, funny to talk about that made the rounds on Reddit, but I didn't hear anybody else talk about it. Somebody discovered that in Google Translate, if you type in seemingly random letters over and over again, you get verses from the Bible.
Religious
you get, like,
tracts.
Yeah. And it still works. I was monkeying around with it earlier today. I was typing in a bunch of stuff in Somali. And it's still spitting out really weird stuff.
Now they say this is because the AI in Translate was trained in many texts, including religious texts.
Because they're the only ones translated into obscure languages.
Let me just try it here. Translate.
Type the letters AAG over and over again, like 19 times into Google Translate.
Okay. The example that the example I saw on Reddit was Maori and dog. But AG, and what language? What language should I do?
Somali.
Somali.
Just AG, like just copy paste.
Is that a Somali word?
No. But if you do that, just like copy paste that like four times, and then add with. Okay, so now.
Oh, I didn't put spaces in. Does that matter? Let me.
That's okay. I think you've got go in. Yeah, so it'll keep.
Now, but I have to change this to, it says Irish was detected.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to change this to Somali and see the aggregation of the ages to be aglons to the ages of the ages of the beginning of the ages of the beginning.
So add on and add on just like a single A to the end of that AG.
That will change it?
Without the space.
No,
without
the space. Without the space.
Yeah.
So this is a, maybe I put too many AGs in. Let's cut them out a little bit. Numbers, 420 names, native agent losses, LTO nation. It's nonsense.
I mean, I took screenshots on my phone because I was getting
They fixed it since then, I bet you, right? So
what I don't know.
We were getting, and we can show the article on Motherboard, which shows dog, which has been, oh, here's the AG. So if you put in dog in Maori a bunch of times, doomsday clock is 3 minutes at 12. We are experiencing characters and a dramatic developments in the world, which indicate we are increasingly approaching the end of times and Jesus' return.
So or, here's what I found interesting.
As a result,
about
the number of the members of the tribe of the sons of Gershon were 150,000. But you know what this is? I recognize this. This is very, very common in the way sometimes artificial intelligence works with stuff. And there's a name for it, which I can't remember, but there's a name for the technique which separates phrases out. Mm. And it is exactly what you'd expect to see when you put in nonsense.
Phonemes?
Although, right, obviously, it was heavily trained on religious texts. Yeah. Right?
So, which is just, that's interesting. And from my vantage point, the interesting piece of that story beyond, like, it's really funny if you type in dog, you get religious texts on the other end. But what's interesting, what the part of that story that should have been interesting is we don't have a list of ingredients, right? So
well, that's always the issue with AI, right? Who's training it? Well, what biases are being introduced unknown?
But even like bias aside, it just highlighted that like maybe yeah. we're at a point where it'd be good to have, you know, the sort of list of like a nutritional label, yeah. right?
These are, they're called Markov chains. That's what I was mm-hmm. trying to remember. And it is, I know about this because programmers sometimes use it to play with as a way of generating real sounding text from kind of random snips of things. And there's actually a Twitter feed of Markov chains using open source texts and things like poetry. And it's actually quite interesting because it has produced stuff that sounds realistic, but it's really just, it's almost as if you cut up a bunch of stuff, little slips of paper, threw it in a hat and pulled it out. Yeah. It would sound like, the whole point of this is it would sound like real speech, except it's not. It's nonsense.
I've used that a couple of times.
Pranking. It's a great way to write proposals.
I've used it.
I was just
going to
say, like.
Yeah, once upon a time I was on a conference and we were talking and we decided to make up this technology as a joke. Fiber channel over Ethernet. Fiber channel.
Yeah, you just take all those. Mm. Those words, those marketing terms.
Yeah, we took a bunch of these and just fed them in, and we got this. And yeah. we declared that the new standard was, and we got journalists calling us to ask us about the technology and whether it was real and how soon it was going to come along. And we had a wild old time.
This is
Fiber Channel over Token Ring.
Karen Meyer wrote this as a demonstration of closure that I was reading the other day, and she's actually created a Twitter account, Functional E. Lear, Markov mashups of Edward Lear's nonsense songs and functional programming snippets. And it makes sense. In a weird kind of way. So that's probably what happened.
I tried to do some functional programming once, and I tell you, it's going to come out like that.
What a wonderful noise they'll be, and at night by the language's type system.
Yes, exactly. That sounds like a real code to me.
And when the sieve turned round and round, and everyone said, if we only live, we too will go to sea in a sieve.
Mm.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, so I guess, I you know, it's funny that you picked up on that, Amy, because I also... picked up on that, and I thought that was really interesting. No one at Google has stepped forward to say what it means, but a professor at Harvard, Andrew Rush, who studies natural language processing and computer translation, said normally internal quality filters would catch this kind of manipulation if it were intentionally done by, say, editors or disgruntled Google employees. He says, more likely that the strange translations are related to a change Google Translate made several years ago when it started to use neural machine translation. We've all seen those weird dreamscapes that neural networks create of artwork and so forth.
This just seems like it's an artifact. Who cares?
It's a hallucination, is what he says.
I guess my point is it says something about optimizing and quality assurance and control. And you've got lots of different groups of people working on different projects.
This is Silicon Valley. There's no such thing as quality control. It's just make it and ship it and damn the...
But I think we're at a point where we ought to start consumers and even not people who are super plugged in, but like, you know, all of us, it's our data that makes the systems run. And I think that we ought to at some point, and just going back to the EU for a moment, I actually think that was the spirit of the GDPR. I think that was part of what was sort of underlying the text. It just wasn't made explicit in a meaningful way. Maybe because at the time nobody thought to...
The best part of this is that the nerds have been caught out looking stupid.
Yeah,
that's it.
Google's response to this is, you put in nonsense, you're going to get nonsense out. What did you want?
Move on. I could care.
I guess my job is to look for patterns, right? So this happened at the same... Well, but there were a couple of things that happened at the same time. So that happened.
A translation system is a flying car. If you feed in garbage,
but the same technology
is being... It's not a flying car crashing into a mountain.
Hang on for a second. So like that happened at the same time that Move Mirror was announced by Google. So this is similar to the face matching fine art program that launched, you know, last year. So this is now where you can sort of stand in front of your webcam and move your body around, and your body will render as many, many, like one of 80,000 images. And they sort of, it creates like a quick movie of all these.
Carson, I have it here. Just go to Carson. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time describing it, but.
So you want to do it?
No, obviously I don't want to do it. But the reason that I
bring I'll
this
do
up,
it.
Well, So the question is,
this is
what's
a
going on
person
here?
Experiment.
This is not just about making it so that people have fun on the internet. They are collecting they're collecting information so that their systems can learn and train in real time. They need more real time data to capture gesture and motion. So, which I don't have a problem with. I just wish that it was disclosed in a way, right? And I don't have a problem that Google used the Bible to train, because it's easy, right? That there's structured data and there's a lot of it in lots of different languages. So that makes sense, but let's just explain what's going on here rather than brushing it off. Leo, you look great. I would not have done it.
I keep getting the same four people. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but I keep getting those women sitting in a line. Is this what Google thinks I look like? All right. I've done my Move Mirror. Thank you very much.
Well, and what you've done is you've just created some free... You've been part of the giant Mechanical Turk. That is, everybody using Google's cool services and products.
But did I give them anything of value there?
Yeah, you absolutely did. You're helping train the system.
Oh, now we're going to get into discussion around why Google should pay me for my data.
Well, but...
Well, at least I guess the point is just there's a lot happening. And
actually, Google says here that they're not sending any images back to the server.
No. Google is saying, so this is important. The fine print is that they are not saving and sending the images back. But machine learning algorithms don't need to store the information.
Oh.
They can extract the data from it and save that.
What they are sending something back, just not those images.
So again, like I don't have a problem with this, but if we look at... My point is that we have checked out. We are falling asleep just as the machines are waking up.
Oh God!
This is the point. Like the little wow. Google Translate spit out some weird apocalyptic doomsday cult, you know, sentences. Ha ha! Isn't that funny? And Google saying, you know, obviously this is a glitch, you know, and when we all move on, or Google launching Magic Move and people sort of thinking it's cool. These things are all connected. Is my point.
Wow.
And they are part of the fabric that we are all inextricably tied into, literally, physically tied into because of our data. And I just think that we ought to be more aware and awake to what's happening.
Amy, you're going dark on us again.
Sorry.
Terrifying.
I'll perk back up.
No, don't perk up. I've got something that'll lighten up your day. the Ring Spotlight Cam. We're going to take a break. Come back more with our great panel, Amy Webb.
Use that to motion capture yourself.
Yeah. But it does send it back to the servers. But not for the same reasons. And it's also great to have Greg Farrow here from the Packet Pushers Network. Our show today brought to you by Ring, the Ring Video Doorbell. I've already told you how great this is. It is a way of keeping an eye on what's going on outside my front door, whether somebody's ringing the doorbell and then it rings it on my phone, no matter where I am in the world, and I can talk to them. I had yesterday on the radio show, I had a mail carrier call, a woman who delivers mail. And she said, I bought a Ring Video Doorbell because everywhere I go, I see these Ring. Every time I'm delivering mail, I see these doorbells. The other day, I walked up to deliver a package. The woman said, I can't talk to you right now. I'm not here right now. I'm in Hawaii. But I'll tell you what, give that to my neighbor, and I'll pick it up when I get back. And the mail lady was so blown away. She said, I went out and got a Ring Video Doorbell. She also mentioned she doesn't have internet access, so it's not that useful. But if you have internet access, this is an amazing thing. You literally get, and I love it. We know who's on our doorstep. It actually has motion sensors. So even if somebody walks around in front of your house, you set the area that it's monitoring. You'll get that feedback. And you can talk to anybody at your front door. So you can say, get away from there. Or you could say, leave the package behind the bush. You could say, "What?" You know, it's great. You can know when not to answer the door. How many times has the doorbell rang and you want to kind of like peek out through the curtains and make sure it's not that annoying neighbor, right? All the time. Now I just look at my phone and go, I can answer that one. You know what you could do? You go on and say, I'm not here right now. Go away. I'm out of town for the next year. Now, just like the Ring Video Doorbell, you got your Ring Floodlight Cam. It's a motion activated. Well, it's a floodlight. You've seen those before. The side of the house, you walk out, the light goes on so you can empty the trash. That's nice. But what if you added? What if you did this? First of all, make it LEDs so they're never going to burn out. They're bright. They're clear. They're great. Then add the camera, the speaker, the microphone, the motion sensor from the Ring Video Doorbell. Now the light comes on. You can see who's there. You get notified no matter where you are anywhere in the world. You can talk to them. You can listen to them. And if it's a bad guy and they don't get out of the way, you just press a button on your phone and a 110 decibel alarm goes off and they go running. This is so great. We have them all around the house. It's home security. We use it to monitor our cats, too. It's good for that. I like to look at the Twitter feed on Ring because they have all sorts of stuff. Here's a 3 a.m, right? 3 a.m. This is the video from the Ring Spotlight Cam. This guy 3 a.m. They're going up to their car. He's in his car, and now
get out of my car.
He says, "Get out of my car."
Hey, get out of my car! I'm calling the cops.
And they go running.
My God, that's crazy.
They go running. Is that not awesome? If you go to twitter.com/ring, you can watch these videos. They're phenomenal. Stop crime before it happens. Make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Ring.com/twit. You can get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/twit. Ring.com/twit. Save it to $150 on your Ring of Security kit. 1, 2, or 3 spotlight cams and a Ring Video Doorbell. You get your choice of the original Ring, the new really sweet Ring with it. It's all HD. It's awesome. Okay, we got to cheer everybody up. We can't leave on a bad note. Is it good news that Jeff Bezos is now the richest man who ever walked the earth? $150 billion?
I'm more concerned that we're
seeing... That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
It's also a distortion.
It's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
And it's such a distortion of capital. It takes us back to like Rockefeller era.
It is.
When those people had so much money that politics and society was beholden to the individual. They could make a decision and then everybody... And we've already seen that. Like Amazon this week announced they were going to make switches and Cisco's share price dropped by $10 billion and Amazon's went
amazing.
Up by $11
billion. Amazon buys PillPack, the online pharmacy.
Yep.
Takes billions of dollars off the table for CVS, Walgreens, all these... Because it's like, well, if Amazon's going to do it, your history.
Those companies fell by $19 billion, but Amazon's share price went up by $19. Effectively, they bought that company for nothing.
Oh, wow.
So that goes back to this.
They literally
antitrust.
Bought that company for zero money. Not only did they get their share price... As soon as they announced they were buying PillPack, their share price went up by the value
Same
of
amount
the
that
buyer.
The others went down.
And more importantly, their competitors went down by much as well.
Wow.
So they already have a competitor. So we're seeing sort of this is where, again, Amazon in U.S. competitive law, antitrust law, the consumer is getting a good deal. They're not being financially disadvantaged. Therefore,
actually,
it will continue.
It's more than that in the United States. So Amazon has very, very smartly and strategically made acquisitions and across different spectres. So they don't own any controlling stake in any one industry.
That's right.
Exactly. Which is brilliant.
But they're also
really smart.
They can also sit down in front of antitrust courts and say, we reduced the price on this thing. We improved market access. We improved consumer value. Therefore, it's in the interest of the society to let us continue to bring this product to market. There's no way an antitrust will ever stick.
So I was in the city. I was in New York a while ago getting a lunch at the little stall where I like to get lunch sometimes.
What kind of food? Is it halal? What are you getting?
No, it's not halal.
I love halal. Don't knock halal.
It was a super unhealthy Italian hoagie.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Oh,
man.
I know. It's like,
oh, I love those. That's the thing I miss the most about moving out here is Italian subs.
There's a really unhealthy, delicious place.
Sometimes you just got to have the good stuff.
Where is it?
So it's like in the the Plaza Hotel in Midtown. Beneath there is like this food hall sort of place. So anyhow, so I'm down there.
Oh, I've been in that food hall. I love that food hall.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm getting my sandwich. I'm like in between meetings, and I look over and I see this person, and I'm like, holy cow, that's Jeff Bezos. What the hell is it? And he was by himself, like he was with another person, but there were no security guards. And then I'm like, no, that makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
Why would he just be hanging out? Yeah. You know, nobody else seems to know who he is, but
he's
me.
He's a kidnapping target.
So I'm kind of, you know, looking, I'm trying not to like stare at all, but I'm like, no, that's gotta be him. He has a very particular look. He has a very distinctive,
if he laughs, you're going to know, because there's nobody laughs like
that. Yeah, it was him. It was totally him. But what was interesting is, you know, he went around. So here's the world's richest man ever. And he's, you know, I think most people would have absolutely no idea what he looks like. If they saw him in person, most people would have no idea who he is. And I bet you if you went out and asked people who is Jeff Bezos, most people wouldn't even know what that name is. So,
wow. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg probably couldn't go out in public. Bill Gates couldn't go out in public.
No,
but Bezos,
but to me, that's like, but that's kind of like
what
part
was he
of the
doing?
Amazon.
Was he getting lunch?
I don't know. He was wandering around the food court.
What the? No.
With me.
No.
That was, I know, but it was him.
No.
She was totally him.
He's worth $150 billion. He should be in a Sherman tank.
I mean, he was worth like slightly less at that point.
Oh, that's but,
well, like that $140 billion or something.
Oh, that
explains. But to me, like that's such a good window, you know, because that's so Amazon, right? We know very, very little about this company.
Yeah.
We know very little outside of the acquisition announcements about what the grand plan is.
You sure
as somebody who is
there.
A... From my vantage point, Jeff Bezos is probably our most interesting and most capable long-term future thinker in America. So I play as
you know,
close attention
I would
as
disagree I very strongly. There's two things that Jeff Bezos has done. He's done a massive job of avoiding tax because he's never made a profit and he's used government taxes effectively to grow his business. That's the first thing. So he's never all of the infrastructure.
By the way, that's something here in America we celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. So he's all of the money, all of the growth that he's managed to achieve out of his company has been done because he's never paid taxes. So all of the infrastructure, all the roads, all the buildings, all the people,
right.
All the social services, Amazon has contributed effectively.
He doesn't pay
zero.
The people all that well either.
He doesn't pay people very all that well, and they're expected to work extremely hard. Average life of an Amazon employee is 18 months. They just don't last for very long. He's running out of people to employ.
Well, how is that? So how is that making him not a long-term strategic thinker about?
Because all he's doing is he's an expert at exploiting the system.
Man.
All he's managed to do is hack the system. He hasn't actually created a genuine innovation.
Well, but
the ability to sell something slightly more efficiently than it did before is not an innovation.
He's innovative because he's figured out a way to get a small percentage of every financial transaction in the United States of America.
He's done rent extraction.
I look at their patents. I look at some of their crazy experiments and some of the stuff that they're doing with minds and looking at sensor data. I think he is brilliant and I think he has a long-term plan that he is executing on,
yes.
Whether or not that's apparent to
but
all of us.
It's not an innovation plan. It's an exploitation plan.
I don't know.
All his company sucks in vast amounts of open source data and then spits it back at people as AWS as to make a profit, but gives nothing back to open source. So, you know, it's not like he's not genuinely contributing to society. He's taking from society.
Well, how about Elon Musk? Is he contributing to society?
He's trying, and at least he's a lot more transparent than Amazon is. Right?
Here's my headline of the week. This is the best headline for the whole week.
Yeah.
Tesla boss Elon Musk has reached an agreement with a Colorado potter who accused the billionaire of using his farting unicorn without permission.
Yeah, but they looked pretty similar. Did you see it?
You've seen one farting unicorn. You've seen them all.
I mean, it's a ridiculous farting unicorn. I mean, that's... It's pretty darn close to the original, if you ask me.
Well, apparently there's been a settlement. I'm happy to report that we have reached an agreement with Tesla that resolves our issues in a way that everyone feels good about it, says the potter. It's clear there were some misunderstandings that led to this escalating. I'm just glad that everything's been cleared up. I've always been a Tesla fan, and I'm looking back to making pots and selling them in, including a link, my online store.
I don't know. Elon Musk, his PR people or lack of PR people has certainly caused him some headaches over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, we talked about it last week. It's just bizarre. You know what? You got the right idea. What was his explanation for the pedo comment?
No, that part I didn't hear. I heard the explanation for the submarine and the building the submarine.
Oh,
and
I think that's fine. He thought it was a good idea. He leapt into action. He did something. You can't knock it.
Yeah, the comment, though, was, I don't know.
The pedo comment, I don't get that.
Like, at what point does somebody go over and offer something to... There are teams of experts in Thailand, well-trained, highly expert cave divers who know exactly what they're doing. At exactly what point did they ask him for help? Or exactly what point...
Well, they didn't. He just said, I got a submarine...
Yep.
And no, he told.
So
he
made a judgment in his opinion that he.
Oh, the company did ask him.
The people there are incompetent, and he should leap into action.
No, he was asked. He was asked
by who?
Well, he said that he was asked.
Yes, he said he was asked. Right? There are people involved. They flew in teams of divers. They had over 80 divers, highly trained, expert cave divers on the spot. Right, moving in and out of those caves. The Thai military was.
It's a simple thing.
Yeah, it's a simple thing.
The problem is Twitter. Just get off Twitter. You keep saying Twitter's good, Amy Webb. Have you changed your tune?
What are you talking about?
She's selling books.
No, you don't like Twitter.
That is, hashtag
lie.
Misinformation.
Fake news.
I've literally never said Facebook is good. In fact, I have almost completely stopped using Twitter over the past several weeks.
Yep.
I went completely off
you
social media.
You and me and Maggie Haberman like this.
And I just don't see a point in coming back. Yeah.
No more Twitter. Yeah. Twitter makes people do stupid things.
Yeah. I just, it's just one of those things. Next thing, Silicon Valley, a lot of people in Silicon Valley think they have solutions for the entire world. And I sort of see what Elon did with the Thai cave thing as sort
of a symptomatic. It's very Silicon Valley.
Thing, right?
It is very Silicon Valley.
I've done
the smartest
these things.
Man in the room,
I'm the smartest
I can help.
Man in the room. I'm going to go there and make
but
it better.
You can't knock him for trying to help. It's not like he got in the way.
You don't go and help unless you're asked. I mean, the Thai government, if there's nobody else helping.
If somebody falls on the street, you go and help them up.
Yeah. But if there's 20 people there helping, you don't go in and help them up.
Well, you don't nudge other people out of the way and say, let me in.
And that's my point exactly. That's exactly what he did.
You think he did that?
Here's a better question. Let me ask you a question.
Right? And it's
if
not like there was
no. Go ahead, Amy. Yeah, go ahead.
If he had done all of this and made all of the preparations without announcing any of it on Twitter and had shown up and had contributed to helping everybody out, would we have the same negative reaction? And my answer is no. I think the problem that we have is that we all somehow feel compelled to announce our, you know, to announce our philanthropy.
Where do you announce that? On Twitter.
On Twitter, right. So
Twitter
is
the 4chan of this generation. It is a
bane. It's become that way.
It's a bane.
I don't have that problem with Twitter, but then I'm not. I'm not volunteering to help people that don't need helping.
You're going to say something on Twitter you regret. I promise you. Maybe tonight.
There's a compulsion, you know. So we have to ask ourselves, because a lot of our conversation today has been around the evil, like the people, the sort of know-it-alls of Silicon Valley and them trying to skirt rules or, you know, whatever. And again, I think a lot of these people and a lot of these companies have our best interests at heart. I really do. I don't think they're our
There's
folks
no
out there. I
don't what Elon Musk has done with SpaceX and with Tesla and Solar City. Yeah.
And he's
we wouldn't be driving electric vehicles if Tesla hadn't made them cool again.
No question. I am not attacking the man personally. I'm saying in this particular case, he overstepped the mark and he should be criticized for that.
All right.
He was not welcomed. He was not invited. The Thai government was in action. It had brought in dozens of divers and experts from around the world to help it with the rescue. It was not doing nothing
context.
He would not needed.
Hey? We're missing context. And this is why.
Yep.
So again, like, but so he's got some kids. We have no idea. It's entirely plausible that one of his kids almost drowned at one point.
Yep.
I'm a mom, right? And I'm a mom of a young kid. And hearing what was happening, there was a part of me that was like, ah, you know, is there,
yeah,
I wish
don't
I could
fly to another country and undermine
well,
a government led solution
so again,
to a major
like,
issue and pretend
you,
that you're that's not acceptable behavior. That's not an adult in action. That's a child
and
throwing
I
a tantrum.
I am not here to defend Elon Musk. All I'm saying is
I'm not attacking him. I'm saying that is not mature behavior.
Sir, so what I'm right? what I'm saying is that a lot of this is playing out now over on Twitter.
Yep.
And what I was just trying to say is it's entirely plausible because we weren't there that that he was asked for some help because of, you know, he was already set up to do some of
that. He tweeted
that,
although I noticed that that tweet has now been deleted. So yeah. He said he was repeating.
Who knows? The problem is
who
that
knows?
Stuff
it's
gets
Twitter.
Posted on Twitter and then the rest
sake,
of us
the
spend
CEO
our
of
time.
Vast companies. Who asked him? The secretary of this junior under, you know, one of his buddies who happened to
well,
be
we don't, you know
in
what,
Thailand
Greg,
on holidays? Like, you know.
You might be right. You might be wrong. We don't know. That's the real problem.
Look, he's a CEO
and
of
one of our
really
business.
Successful companies. It would have to come from the Thai government.
Comment. On it,
yeah,
and it's like the vitriol that comes out in that commentary, yeah. Which is creating yes. This like environment where we're having these stupid arguments with each other.
He yeah. Did. There is this you know. Post, a request from Richard Stanton. We're worried about the smallest lab. Please keep working on the capsule details. This is Elon's, you know, apparent, you know, request. So I don't know. I don't think we have to weigh in on that. I like Elon. I like what they're
yes,
doing.
Very
it
much.
Cost the pedo comment cost Tesla that and other things $2 billion in market value. It was a very expensive comment. Get off Twitter.
Yes.
I think that's the
get
that
off
is the
Twitter.
Best advice from this entire episode is just like we all need to get off Twitter.
Get off
gets
Twitter.
A lot of value out of Twitter, right?
Get
so
on
the,
Pokemon
the
Go because you cannot hurt anybody.
I don't get the value out that I used to, and I'm one of the earliest users, and I was a power user for a long time, and I just don't get the value out of it that I used to.
Okay. And the flip side of that is he gets a lot of value and a lot of exposure. He's got a lot of followers. He tweets something out, and he can sell a hell of a lot of flamethrowers for zero effort.
You know, it really is interesting.
What's wrong with that?
Is that the thing that people are most willing to argue about and vociferously defends, they're always the smallest things, the things that are the least important. And I think that that's something we got to keep in mind. This doesn't really matter in the scheme of things.
It doesn't.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm gonna call this one.
What are you gonna call it?
I don't know yet, but I'll think of something. Amy Webb, God bless you. I can't wait to read the new book. Got to read the old book first, though, folks. The signals are talking. AmyWebb.io. She is keeping an eye on the future, so we don't have to. Thank you, Amy, for being here.
Thank you.
You're just
it's always
marvelous.
Fun.
You too, Greg Farrow. Man, I love both of you. This I knew. See, aren't you smart? Aren't we smart, Carson? You were right. Don't put another person on this table. They'll never get a word in edgewise.
Sorry about that.
Well, it's
you're
all
fun
of us
to debate with. No, this was
it's
good.
All of us, baby.
I learned a ton. I have a notebook full of ideas after today. This was awesome.
EA6, okay? EA6. Greg Farrow. You can hear more Greg Farrow on his podcast at the Packet Pushers Network. Or follow him on Twitter. He apparently thinks it's a good thing. Ethereal Mind is his Twitter handle.
It's snarky, but, you know.
Nerdy. Snarky, but delicious. Just like all of Twitter. You guys are so
there's
great.
There's your title.
Yeah, snarky, but delicious.
There you go.
No, there were so many good titles floating across this one. I'll tell you, this is going to be a hard one to pick. Thank you so much for being here. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific. You actually could watch it live if you wanted. 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. A couple of ways to do that. You could be in the studio. I had a great studio audience. Put up with our snarky but delicious show for the last 2.5 hours. It's okay. Got to warn you. It's a long haul, but you can go to the bathroom, right? We don't lock you in. No, we allow you to go to the bathroom. Just email tickets at twit.tv so we can make sure we have a chair for you. You can also watch the live stream, twit.tv/live. There's live audio and video there from a variety of sources. You pick the source you like. You can hum along. You can also, if you're going to do that, you might as well be in the chat room too, because that's where the fun kids are. They are great. In fact, some of the best lines from the show today that I didn't use because came from the chat room. Just great stuff in here. irc.twit.tv. irc.twit.tv. If you can't watch live, you can download shows, audio or video, from twit.tv. That's our website. Every show's there on demand. Subscribe in your favorite podcast application so you get it the minute it's available every week. That way you'll have it for your Monday commute. Or, you know what I love more and more? I feel like I listen to more podcasts now than ever before thanks to these, you know, voice assistants. You can say, Echo, listen to Twit. Or actually, I think for this one, you have to say, listen to This Week in Tech. Or you could do it with your Google Home or your Amazon or your Siri or your whatever. Just you could be in an empty room and just shout it and see if it plays. Listen to This Week in Tech. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next week. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
In the game. Doing the Twit.